This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. David D. Eichhorn. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Today is March 29, 2005, and it's 1:06 p.m. Central Standard Time. And, David, you are in Fleming, Ohio. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Dave, why don't we start with some biographical information on yourself. Can you tell me when you were born, where you were born, and a little bit about your early childhood?
Okay, I was born in Noble County, Ohio, August 16, 1950. I was the youngest of 11 children.
Wow, that's a big family.
It was a big family. My parents, they started housekeeping during the Depression, and like I said, they didn't have anything back in the 30s, and
right.
Of course, I was. Time I come along, things had improved. Grew up on a farm. We all worked,
So you all lived out in the county, out away
yeah.
from the city.
Yeah. Like I say, when I was 4 years old, we moved to Washington County, Ohio, which is roughly 40 miles from where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I grew up on a farm, grew up in a house that didn't have indoor plumbing.
Wow.
Grew up with an outhouse, and like I said, it was on a farm. We milked cows and separated the milk, sold cream, and fed the skim milk to hogs and
mm-hmm.
raised chickens, and always kind of felt like I didn't have as much as the kids whose fathers worked in the factories and stuff. But, I had a good childhood. I had to work growing on a farm. But,
right.
Grew up with it. And, it's not like something that you had and you lost, So I had a good childhood. Like I said, I grew up, early on with a strong work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Was
it a working farm, Dave? What kind of farm was it?
Well, like I said, we had cattle and chickens and hogs, and and grew a big garden. My mom did a lot of canning. She baked bread, and it was fairly self-sufficient. This is, kind of like Appalachia through here, southern Ohio. It's hill country. I guess it's, I wouldn't classify it as poor, but, we always had electricity and plenty to eat, plenty to wear, and stuff, so.
Tell me about your brothers and sisters. You were the youngest out of 11.
Right. There was six boys and five girls. As far as military service, my dad was too young for World War I and too old for World War II, so.
Wow.
But I had some uncles in World War II on my mom's side, and had an uncle killed in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest brother, he was in Korea in 1950. There was 18 years between my oldest brother and I. So. Other brother was two brothers in the Air Force and two brothers in the Army.
Wow, a lot of military experience.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, my dad's brother, he was in World War I, but he died before I was born, never got to met him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Did your family members talk to you about their military experiences? Did you ask them?
No, it wasn't really discussed much. Because, I was really probably a junior high age before I realized that my uncle was killed in Italy.
Hmm.
And, like I said, my paternal uncle, my dad's brother, who was in World War I, he wasn't mentioned. He committed suicide.
Wow.
So that wasn't, it just wasn't talked about.
Right.
Like I say, growing up, the kind of unwritten rule around the house was shut the hell up and get to work.
Right.
I mean, that's just the way I was raised.
Well, what was your... Tell me about your dad. What was he like? How would you describe him?
Quiet. You know, the only thing my dad and I ever did together was work.
Really?
Yeah, he was quiet. He didn't go to town. You know, as far as physical affection, I mean, or, you know, we never told each other we loved him, but we knew it, you know. I mean,
yeah.
It was, you know, I mean, just kind of hard to describe, but,
yeah.
You know, I can never remember my dad ever telling me he loved you or my mom or anybody, or he just, I guess, worked, and that was it.
Right.
But you know, I had a good father. I mean, like I said, that's probably the way he was raised, you know, just, so.
What about your mother? What was she like?
My mom liked to get out and talk a little bit more. She was more, she would go places, and, you know, my dad would stay home. I mean, you know, the only, well, we did go to my maternal grandparents once a month. One Sunday a month, we'd go, they lived back up in Noble County. We'd go up there about once a month. And that's about the only socializing my dad ever did. I mean,
really?
He didn't go to any school functions or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom did. She would get out and gab and whatnot.
Right. Did you get along with all your brothers and sisters?
Most of the time, we'd be fighting 1 minute. And, you know, the next. I'd say me being the youngest, always kind of thought my exploits and adventures didn't quite measure up, but
right.
But you know, they did. We got along. My closest brother was 4 years older than me,
mm-hmm.
and I had a sister 3 years older.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Do you guys see each other today?
Not much. Let's see, there's the sister next to me. She just passed away here a year ago in November. And I've had three brothers deceased and two sisters. So, we don't really visit much today. I suppose my sister in Colorado and I is the closest. There was 11 years between us. So,
right.
But that's just happened in the last 10 years that we've become closer and talking.
So you grew up, it sounds like, really working hard, you know, on that farm. What kind of things did you do on the farm?
Okay, well, I drove tractor from 8 years old on. You know, milked cows by hand from 8 or 9. That, and then I'd haul out to the neighbors in hay season, and you know, fence, and of course you had daily chores to feed the animals, and you know, start to take care of animals, you know, because that was our livelihood, I guess.
Right.
And then my mom, she did take a job as a cook at the school when I was in like the second grade or so. So had a little bit of extra income. So.
Did tell me about your schooling and going to school as a young boy. What was that like for you?
Well, got my butt beat.
Really?
I suppose today they'd put me on Ritalin or something, but but you know, that's just a typical boy. If what the teacher was trying to teach, if I took an interest in it, I did okay. If I didn't, you know, I just didn't. But I didn't have any trouble. I guess I've been blessed with better than average intelligence. And, you know, I could just pick up enough to get decent grades and never have to apply myself. So.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was kind of a class clown and whatnot a little bit. So.
So you're kind of naturally smart, and you picked up on things relatively well, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, basically, you know, I mean, but I never really had to apply myself either. I mean, just kind of picked up naturally, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any favorite subjects, Dave?
Yeah, more or less history and geography and science, you know. I'd get A's in that, but English and writing and spelling would be down C, you know. But, like, you know, history and geography interested me, so I, you know, I guess that's why I did better, because I was interested in it.
Right.
I wasn't interested, I didn't really apply myself. So.
Yeah. Now, did you go to the same school all the way through 12th grade?
Well, more or less, they built a new school when it was after the fourth grade. I mean, my first 4 years, it was like, my second, third grade was in a one-room school. There was one building with three grades in it, and then another building with one grade in it. And, you know, it had outside toilets and stuff, so. But then they built the new school and went there from the fourth through the eighth. Then my new high school was built at the same time as the new grade school. The same school district, yes.
Okay. What did you continue working on the farm as you were going through all your school years?
Pardon?
Did you continue working on the farm as you
Yeah. I'd have chores to do in the morning and chores to do in the evening. And, I wanted to play sport, but my dad, of course, the older brothers got to because there's more kids at home, but my dad, his health was starting to fail, and so I couldn't play sport. So.
But you wanted to?
But yes, I wanted to. I did play 1 year. I talked my dad into it, and then got pissed off because I wasn't playing enough football, and I guess so I quit that. I continued working on the farm right up until the day I left.
Do you look back, Dave, and resent that a little bit, that you could have been a good athlete and done that kind of thing?
I probably resented it for a little while, but I've come to terms with it. You know, that's just as I've gotten older, that's just the way things was.
Sure.
You know, I can understand it more now. And,
right.
But it was a big disappointment at the time, as a 14-year-old.
Sure.
Whatnot. So.
Well, tell me about girls. Did you have girlfriends?
Yeah.
Did you have time for that? I guess is what I'm asking.
Oh, yeah. But, I was kind of shy. But, it was back then they had what they called 3-2 beer in Ohio. And, you could get that at 18. So there's always 18-year-olds in high school, You start drinking beer, fresh from high school. That helped with the girls, or helped me with the girls, I guess. Kind of allowed me to be more relaxed and, not as self-conscious or shy,
Right.
I guess maybe I had low self-esteem or something, they'd say. I don't know. But then there was a girl that pretty much dated all the way through high school, who I actually wound up marrying 10 days after I got back from Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I did okay with the girls, I guess.
Well, tell me a little bit about growing up in the 1950s in America. What do you remember about popular culture and President Eisenhower and all that kind of thing?
Well, I wanted a Davy Crockett coonskin hat. Remember that? Didn't get one, but I wanted one. Went out to the neighbors had a TV. We didn't. When I was 7 or 8, I was, 12 years old before we got a TV. So we'd go out to the neighbors to watch TV. So I can remember listening to Gunsmoke and the Lone Ranger on radio with, my dad and mom and older brothers and sisters and stuff. Even after we got a TV, my dad never watched TV. Mom did and the other kids, they were still home, but Dad, he didn't change. He still listened to the radio.
Oh, really?
He never watched TV.
Did you all ask him to come join you?
Yeah. Yeah, I might go watch the Cincinnati Reds when they was playing on TV. He followed the baseball on the video every summer, you know.
Yeah.
And then with there'd be some neighbors come in and play cards. And, you know, we played a lot of games outside growing up, you know, hide and seek and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'd go down to the creek and swim. And, you know, we didn't all work. Had a lot of fun. I mean, growing up on a farm is a great place for kids. So,
yeah, it sounds like it. Both, you know, has its advantages and disadvantages, I guess, as every situation does.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so tell me a little bit about, you mentioned the Cincinnati Reds, and I wanted to ask you about that. Did you follow pro sports as a boy, or did that come later?
Well, no, I started right probably 10, 11 years old listening to Reds, and an older brother, he took me down to a ball game when I was 14 or 15, but my dad, they asked him to go, he wouldn't go.
Really?
Yeah. So,
wow.
Yeah, it might go 3 weeks or 4 weeks. My dad never leave the farm.
Well,
you know, we'd go to town about once a month and get groceries. And stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, was he from that area?
Basically, yeah.
Okay. Well, Dave, tell me about your high school years. You're still working on the farm. Your grades, are they okay? Are you a good student?
Yeah, my grades got better in high school for some reason. I don't really understand that. But I was freshman, sophomore year, you know, honor roll, being A, mm-hmm. A and B, but I took a more general course than, like I say, my freshman year, and then I thought, well, maybe go to college since my grades are good. So,
right.
I got switched over to a college prep course, and I did okay in the Spanish, I took an interest in it, but algebra I got left behind,
mm-hmm.
and my grades went down, but, you know, still passed with a D, but then I went back to a general course.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get through school and get off the farm and get a job and make money, I guess.
So you did want to get off the farm?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You didn't, I guess one of your older brothers or more were going to work the farm when your dad passed or retired?
Well, it was never discussed. Matter of fact, I bought the farm that I grew up on right now. That's where I'm sitting.
Really?
My dad died in 74, and I bought this place in November of 75, and still here.
Wow. Wow, okay.
Run a few cows, and got me a horse.
Uh-huh.
Lots of work, you know, I'm worked out shift work. So.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Tell me, Dave, about your memories there during your high school years of what was happening in the world and what was going on with Southeast Asia and Vietnam. What years were you in high school?
64 to 68.
Okay, and these are crucial, very active years for the Vietnam War. What do you remember about that? And what did you hear in high school? And what did you guys think about it?
Well, we thought, you know, if the domino theory, we had to make the stand, keep it, you know, it was basically, you know, everybody was for it, you know. I remember, you know, probably 65, 66, you know, they said, well, we'll have it settled within, you know, before the election, you know. That's when my brother, he got drafted in 65, and he went to Vietnam. He was there 66, 67. In Saigon there. So.
Mm-hmm. Did he make it through?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I think he had some pretty good duty, I don't know, but, you know, I never got to see Saigon, so but I've heard stories of it.
Right, right.
And, you know, I've heard stories early on, you know, some of the pretty good duty, you know, some of the earlier advisors had, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, before it really got hot. But,
mm-hmm.
But basically, you know, everybody was, you know, making a stand, or it was for it. And then, you know, the hippies and the peace movement come in, and you know, I never really thought about it much.
I mean, what do you think of the draft? I mean, you know that if you guys didn't go on to college after you graduated, then you
were... Well, they wouldn't draft me. yeah, I could have went to college. And, you know, my dad, I remember he even said, you know, he had enough money to send me if I wanted to go. And my oldest brother, he was in the Air Force, one in Korea. As a matter of fact, he spent 23 years in the Air Force and retired.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted me to sign up, you know, the Air Force sent me to college, then I do the, you know, 6 years.
Right.
But, you know, that was too long a time at 18 years old.
Right.
So I just figured, well, I just, looking back, I wasn't too bright. you know, I just didn't think it would happen to me, I guess.
Right.
Did
your parents want you to go to college, or did you have aspirations to go to college?
No, not real strong. I mean, yeah, they would have wanted me to. I mean, like I said, Dad said, you know, he was a pony, had some money to pony up to go, and if I wanted to, but... I'd have just partied and flunked out if I did had a wish.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but it just wasn't a big thing for me, I guess. So I just wanted to get me a job and make some money.
Right. So tell me what happened in 68 when you did graduate.
Okay. Got off the farm. well, actually, I was still 17 when I graduated. And so nobody would hire me. I couldn't find a job that summer or fall. So actually I just bummed around and worked on the neighbor's farm and, you know, here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following spring, which was 69, they went on a farm silo crew. But, you know, I didn't really want to stay on the farm. There wasn't that much money in it.
Right.
And, you know, I wanted to get away from my parents. You know, like I said, growing up, my dad never drank or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of looked down on it, and I wanted to get out and drink and retail and
right.
Have fun. And, you know, with my father there, I just kind of, you know, felt like I wasn't doing the right thing. You know?
Right.
So I wanted to get away from the farm and, you know, get to the big city. And
mm-hmm.
So I went out on a silo crew.
A silo crew?
Yeah, building farm silos.
Okay.
Got to travel over to Pennsylvania and Maryland,
mm-hmm.
New York. And then that June, my sister come back from Colorado for a visit.
Mm-hmm.
And said there's plenty of work out here. So I went back to Colorado with her in June. And got a job while I was building Interstate 25 there between south of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a job right off the flagman with general labor,
mm-hmm.
right off the bat. And then got this letter for my 19th birthday to report for pre-induction physical.
Wow.
And well, I was kind of homesick too, I guess, a little bit when I come home. So, you know, I could have took my physical out in Colorado, but I come back to Columbus and took my physical.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, passed with flying colors.
Mm-hmm.
So then, that was in September, I went to work with this silo crew that built industrial silos.
Mm-hmm.
And, worked with him a couple months, and then I got some draft notice there in December of 69.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 days later, I got a notice that it had been rescinded because it went to the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to draw numbers. My birthday was number 4. So come January, I got another draft notice. So I kind of was a downer.
Right. Did you, you had hopes, I guess, of avoiding that.
Yeah, you know, and the thought never occurred to me to go to Canada. You know, I mean, you know, it was, I guess, duty to do it, I guess.
Right. Did you feel that? I mean, is that something very conscious for you, that you were serving your country and that bit, or were you like, well, I don't have a choice, I have to do this?
Well, it's more like I don't have a choice. I mean, you know, my choices was go to Canada, go to jail, or go to the military. So.
Right.
So, you know, I really didn't have a choice. But what I did do is I went and took the went to the Army recruiter and got the 2-year enlistment, because the guy I went to school with had got drafted 2 months ago into the Marine Corps. There were, I don't know, a lot of people weren't aware that they were drafting into the Marine Corps, but at least I wasn't until I found out that he got drafted into the Marine Corps, and I didn't want to go to the Marine Corps, so I took the 2-year enlistment in the Army.
Right.
And the only thing, I had to leave at least 2 days before my induction date. So that's how I wound up in the Army.
How did you feel about it when you got that draft notice, that second draft notice? What were you feeling at that point?
Wasn't feeling good.
Yeah.
It was sad. I guess sadness would describe the feelings more than anything.
Were you living there on the farm with your folks?
Back and forth. You know, I was working out on the road, but,
right,
you know, I was coming back. It was the home base here on the farm.
How'd they feel about it?
I don't think they was real happy. I mean, I know my dad said something about all the kids, you know, like in Marietta, which is the county seat, you know, and you know, you look around at the kids that were getting drafted and the ones that weren't, and, you know, it's, well, just plain ain't fair.
Right. Was your mom and dad, were they for the war or against the war or indifferent? Do you remember?
I can't really remember what they never really said a whole lot about it. As I recall, I know they were worried a lot, but you know, they had my two sons, and my older brother through Korea, and my brother next to me through Vietnam. So you know, sure, they're thinking, you know, our luck's going to run out.
Right. Did your older brother who went to Vietnam, did he talk to you about what he did?
No, not really, other than the, you know, the drinking and the partying.
Right.
Never really talked much about it.
How about the brother who went to Korea? Did he talk about his stuff that happened to him over there?
No, it's never really discussed.
Okay. Well, what did you think, before we talk about going forward there after you got into the Army, what did you think about the anti-war movement that was happening in 68, 69, 70, before you went in?
Well, I thought there was a bunch of losers, and, you know, they... thought they needed to shut up and, you know, get behind the troops, I guess.
Right.
You know, the decision they made. And, but I didn't have much use for them, I guess.
Well, did you think that you would do well in the military in that kind of lifestyle, or is this something that you weren't sure about?
I really wasn't sure about it. you know, I knew I had enough sense, you know, to keep my mouth shut and do what I was told.
Right.
I mean, I didn't know if it'd take all the harassment and whatnot, or you know, I didn't know how I'd do it.
Right. Did any of your friends get drafted around the same time, or were you pretty much by yourself?
I went by myself. There was another kid from Belpre. You know, there's two of us from this county went at the same time. But there was others that I went to school with that were drafted, and some enlisted in the Air Force and Navy. And I couldn't see spending 4 years. I could have, you know, I could probably got into the Air Force or Navy, but I couldn't see spending 4 years.
Right.
That was a long time back then. Today it's nothing.
Well, tell me where you did your basic training. You took off in, this is in January 70?
February of 70.
February 1970. Where did you go for your basic?
Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Wow, okay. So what was it like there at Bragg? What were your first impressions when we got there?
Holy shit. Well, I was scared.
Yeah.
But, you know, I still, it hadn't been that long since, you know, I've been yelled at home and whatnot. So it wasn't like, you know, I'd been out on my own for a while and then being thrown into a basic. You know, as soon as we got from the reception station to our barracks, the first person the DI hollered for was me.
Why?
Well, he was from this area.
Okay.
So, you know, I lucked out right then.
Yeah. And that was a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it was a good thing.
Yeah.
It was a good thing. And plus, you know, in basic, you know, I went in pretty good shape. I think I went in weighing 183 pounds, come out weighing 181.
Okay.
You know, they picked on the ones that were dumb and the ones that were physically out of shape, you know. I mean,
right.
At least in the, I was at. And then, like I said, the Sergeant Parsons there, he didn't harass me a lot, but some of the other DIs did. I mean, you know, but I got through it okay. I mean, at least they didn't make me a squad leader or anything. So,
So you did not want to be a part of that? You don't
No, I didn't want to be a leadership position. I just wanted to graduate and get on.
Right.
Get my 2 years in and get out.
What do you remember most about basic? What do you see when you think about it right now?
Double time march. Oh, we did a lot of, you know, marching and running and a lot of silly, well, I guess some of them I thought was silly harassment things, like, you know, your footlocker and stuff. Being, you know, called out formation 5:30 in the morning, all this stuff. And the physical, like I said, I come out in a lot better shape than a lot of thought. You know, I think going in on PT test, you had to score 300 to pass or three, I think. I got, first test was about 350, and I only lacked 2 points the maximum when I graduated. So.
Wow.
So, you know, 500 was max, I guess. I got a 498. So. A mile run did me in. I didn't max the mile run.
Okay.
But you know, the physical training is the thing I remember about it. And the harassment, I guess.
Did you do well with that harassment? I mean, were you able to deal with it okay?
Yeah, one time I just almost physically flashed back, but, you know, I was smart enough to know that's not the thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I have lost my temper a couple times in life, and, you know, one time there, come close. You know.
What happened, do you remember?
It was like, it was on the hand grenade range, and, you know, through it, like they had a facade of face of a building, and if it went through the window, you scored higher than if it just hit the window or whatever, mm-hmm. or something, you know. One of the DIs, he called back over there, wanted to know what I got on that. It actually went through the window, supposed to get the highest score.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, of course, you have other trainees scoring you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he had him mark my score down, you know.
Why?
I don't know if he's pushing me to see what I do or what, but, you know, we got, you know, he got my face a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think he said, you want to hit me, don't you, trainee? I think I said, yes, drill sergeant, and I did. And he said, well, why don't you? I said, I don't think it'd be a smart move on my part, I think. You know, it's just right there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that, I don't know, I suppose it's just bullshit.
Yeah. Had this guy been to Vietnam?
I think this one had, maybe.
Did he talk to you all about his experiences?
No, none of them. Well, Sergeant Parsons had. He talked to him about it a little bit.
What did he tell you? Do you remember?
I don't know, Charlie's going to get your ass or something. I remember I said, or I can't really remember. I know we had like a night ambush thing, and he said we would have lost probably five guys out of the squad and stuff.
Wow.
But he was a pretty good shot. I remember out on the firing range, he shot from the hip to mm-hmm. 50 yards and drilled it, you know. But the M16, he's kind of showing off a little.
Mm-hmm. What kind of shot were you? How were you with the weapons?
Fair to lousy.
Oh, really? Had you not handled some weapons on the farm?
Yeah. I mean, I qualified easy enough, but, you know, I just wasn't that good a shot at,
mm-hmm.
as, I guess I would panic a little bit, maybe.
Mm-hmm. But you graduated.
Oh, yeah.
Got through. Now, were they telling you all in basic that you're going to Vietnam, or was this when you went to advanced?
No, they said you could be. Of course, you know, they had a lot of National Guard and reserves going through training with it.
Yes.
You know, they said there was a possibility, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, nobody knew for sure.
So where, when you graduated there at Bragg, where did you go for your advanced training?
Fort Sam Houston. They stuck me in the medics.
Now, why did you get into the medics? Tell me about that.
I have no idea.
Really? You didn't volunteer? They didn't think you'd be quite adept at that? Or?
Well, you know, when I took the test, you know, I scored good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they offered you to... You know, they offered me OCS,
mm-hmm.
different schools, you know, I qualified for any school, but, you know, I'd have to, you know, enlist for another year or, you know, either 3, 4, or 6, you know, to go to some of the other schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I just want to do my 2 years and out.
Right.
So I did not want to be a medic.
Why not?
A lot of responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's just, I would have been much better off being straight infantry, I mean, personally, but, you know, sometimes I like to think I make a difference, but, you know, there's not that much you can do sometimes.
Right. Did you feel like you weren't going to be able to help enough people being a medic, or was it the medical part of it that intimidated you a little bit, or
that I wouldn't do a good enough job, or
mm-hmm.
or I'd do something that caused more harm than good?
Right.
You know, I guess it's part of it.
Okay. When did you go to Fort Sam Houston? What month was this in 1970?
That would have been in May.
Okay. Did you get any time off? Were you able to go back to Ohio?
No. Okay. I just went straight from Fort Bragg to Fort Sam.
Okay. Dave, why don't we take a break for a moment here?
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. David Eichhorn. Today's April 12, 2005. It's 1:37 p.m. Central Standard Time. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, and Dave, you're in Fleming, Ohio. Let's pick up where we left off, and tell me about advanced training. You were sent down there to undergo training as a medic. Tell me about that.
Well, I was kind of surprised at it. It wouldn't have been the schooling I'd picked. I figured, you know, go infantry. But basically, got to Fort Sam Houston, and I guess the first, like a 0 week, they either go get a military driver's license or they had a leadership preparatory course where you could be acting cadre, you know, where the stripes or whatever, and it was supposed to be volunteer, but they wasn't getting enough volunteers, so I got stuck in that. After it again, I guess, you know, like I said, you know, I did good on the tests and stuff.
Right.
So they
thought you were competent.
Yeah.
Okay.
So got drafted in that, and that was just a humongous harassment course and class on leadership skills. And and then, like, your bunk had to been real tight, and your foot locker and stuff. And, you know, you squared away the first day there and went to class that day. While you was at class, the DIs come in and tore up the bunks and the foot lockers and throw stuff from one end of the Bay Area to the other, you know. And, you know, yelled at you a lot to get it back in shape, you know, how awful it was. And, so I endured that for 3 or 4 days and dropped out. And, you know, cause I really wasn't that gung-ho, you know. And so then I got to my training class.
Dave, let me ask you a question real quick. I'm sorry. Do you regret today not sticking with that, or do you think you made the right decision?
It's a wash. I should have just sucked it up and went on, but, you know, I don't really regret it. In another way, I wish I would have pushed myself and got through it, but, you know, it really didn't, real no regrets about dropping out of it. You know, it would have been nice if I would have completed it. But,
and this is the leadership course?
Yes.
Okay.
And it didn't, and in fact, you know, the one DI said I would regret it someday, but after I got back from Vietnam, I ran into a guy that did go through it, and he was an E-4 and I was an E-5, so it didn't help me. I mean, it didn't hurt me. So.
Right, right.
So I guess that maybe if I hadn't made E-5 and he had it, it would have, I'd have had some regrets, but probably not.
Okay. Where did you go after you got out of that after 4 days?
Well, I just hung around there the rest of that week and then went to the training class. And basically, that was, you know, there's very little PT in the medic AIT. It was all, you know, march from one class to another. Everything from putting somebody, you know, giving shots, putting somebody on a bedpan and real stuff. And, I mean, the videos they had were from the Brown Army, the Korea area, you know. And, of course, you had frostbite stuff. I mean, just to run the gamut of the medical field, I mean, the training. But really, I felt incompetent as a medic because, you know, for some reason, I don't know. But I did good in the class, you know. I was a graduate with honors.
Really?
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, I got a certificate. You know, I think you had, it's like 1,000 points, and if you scored 925, it was an honor. I think I wound up 940. You know, I did good.
Right. Had you had any experience before this with medical technology or first aid or anything?
No. No, none at all. And it was the furthest thing from my interest. If I was really going into the military, I'd probably went combat engineers construction, you know. course, like I said, grown them on the farm or running tractors, and been around equipment, and then I worked construction before I got drafted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was completely out of the blue and off the wall.
But you did well.
Yeah.
Can you tell me some of the types of classes you took? What kind of training was the Army offering for your basic medics in 1970?
Well, like I said, some of it was kind of outdated from the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, took notes because, you know, it was become kind of hypochondriac, too. We'd study about certain disease and the illnesses, and then, man, did I get that. I mean, it wasn't drastic, but it played on my mind. I mean, but, you know, I didn't want to do something to screw somebody up.
Right.
And you know, there were a couple who washed out. I mean, that didn't make the grade, too. Training, some of the instructors were fairly good and competent, some weren't. I mean, it's typical, I suppose, run-of-the-mill Army thing. But it was, I'd say, decent training. It was, you know, didn't prepare me at all for Vietnam, but...
Really?
Not really. I mean, other than, you know, it's pretty basic. I mean, as far as first aid, you know, clear the airway, stop the bleeding, treat and protect the wound. There's only so much you can do.
Did they talk to you about specific wounds and like how to treat a stomach shot or arm wound from a rifle round, things like that?
Yeah, they got into treating that, well, like a sucking chest wound.
Right.
And just getting ahead, but 3 days in the field, I ran across one of them that come back to how to treat it. I mean, they recognize it and treat it, you know, there's very little blood, just faint froth, frothy around the wound, and then, you know. Yeah, there were things how to treat specific wounds, and you know, one instructor said he's back then they was putting tourniquets on, you know, and he's seen, or so he said, cases of trying to put a tourniquet around the neck to stop a head wound from bleeding, and I mean, which is no, but I mean, you know, and some different things, and, but. It's been a long time ago. I hadn't really thought a lot about the training, but but before we went, they did give us a 1 week RVN training like thing.
Oh, really? What to expect in South Vietnam?
Yeah, it was. See, none of the classes were going to Vietnam. This was in 70, June of 70. All of them were gone. But my class, all the 2 year RAs and U.S. draftees got orders for Vietnam. There was like 15 of them. They took about the Camp Bullock, which right there close to San Antonio somewhere. We was out there 3 or 4 days. They had a mock village set up. But it did give us an extra week training there.
What did they tell you about the Vietnamese?
I can't really remember other than I can't remember what the training was.
Do you remember if you felt it really strange or you know, a very, very different culture, or was it something that, okay, this makes sense to me, this is not going to, you know, be totally foreign?
It was kind of different. It was totally foreign culture because they kind of masked their feelings or stuff. You know, told us different things. And then when we got in country, they give us a lot of training on the people, too. You know, their cultures were different.
How about language training?
None.
Okay.
I remember.
Did they encourage you all to do civic action, to work on the civilians? You know, medically work on the civilians?
Yeah, I did. In the field, yes. Yeah.
Dave, tell me what about your medical training there. What was the easiest part to you there at Fort Sam?
Easiest, would say, what was the easiest thing?
Sounds like a lot of it was.
Well, I mean, as far as... can't really say anything would be easy other than...
Okay.
You know, like I said, I took the classes easy enough. I picked up stuff to score on the test.
Do you remember anything particularly difficult about it? I mean, what was something that you had trouble doing, do you remember?
Stomach and some of the videos were pretty graphic. I could do and the anal temperature thing. You know, we had to take each other's.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
You know, that was different. One guy, he wanted to go kind of like on me instead of up the anus, he went across more like, I mean, kind of.
Okay. That's very interesting.
Some of the training was, I don't know, just putting me, and how to make beds, too, remember that. I spent time down there.
Uh-huh.
How to make beds with the hospital corners. And, and then we had to give each other shots. How to aspirate in case you get a vein or artery or something. You know.
Did you have any fear of needles?
Not unhealthy fear, a little bit. I know. Well, main thing when you give a shot, don't hesitate. Just jab.
Right.
Well, the guy that's giving me one, he hesitated. And of course, that's worse. You know, because you just want to stick it in there and you know, just push it in there slow. It hurts.
Yeah.
But like I said, you know, I did good with schooling, picked it up. So. I can't really describe the feeling I had. Like I said, you know, I was inadequate for the job. I mean, that was always there.
You felt inadequate for the job?
Yeah.
Like you didn't know enough?
Yeah, didn't know enough. Wasn't, you know, couldn't remember enough really to help anybody. You know, that was always underlying feeling. And, we're just an uneasy feeling underneath the going to the school, the medic thing, you know. It just wasn't my interest.
Did you communicate this to anybody?
No, not then. Through there.
Were you able to talk to anybody there at Fort Sam Houston? Were you able to kind of talk to a counselor about some of these fears and unknowns that you might be facing and were facing there and might face in Vietnam?
No counselor or nothing. A couple of the guys, you know, we'd talk about, you know, in the Bay Area overnight, you know. And, you know, looking back, a couple of the other guys I was friends with, they had the same apprehensions, you know, to do something to screw somebody up or something.
Right. It's a lot of responsibility.
For a 19-year-old.
Yes. Well, when you received your orders to go to Vietnam, you're there at Fort Sam. How did you feel, Dave, when you got that piece of paper and you knew you were going over there?
It's definitely a downer.
Yeah?
Freaking little pit in the bottom of my gut, you know. Just wasn't pleased. I didn't want to go.
Yeah. How about the rest of your members of your unit? How do they feel? Do you remember?
A couple of them same way, and a couple others full of bravado. And, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe it was a show or whatnot, but. You know, we really didn't let each other know what we did feel. I mean, I don't know. I know I was down, but you know, I didn't really say nothing, just smoked through the thing, but a couple other people were gung-ho and ready to go.
Were you all given time off?
Yeah, I got 2 weeks. I think most of the other guys did, too. I got 2 weeks leave.
What'd you do?
I come home and been at home with my parents and my girlfriend. We've been out a couple times. Did some partying.
Yeah. What did your parents think about this?
They weren't too happy, but they really didn't say much. We just really didn't talk. They never really talked about not coming back, you know. I mean, it just wasn't talked about.
Yeah.
What could happen.
What about your brothers?
We just really just didn't talk about it. You know, just, you know, do your time, come back. I mean, you know, it really wasn't talked about.
And your girlfriend, same thing?
About the same thing, I think. Although once I got back in Vietnam, she said I promised we'd get married when I got back. I remember that.
She did say that?
Yeah.
Did she keep that promise?
Oh, when I got back, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess that would have given you something to look forward to there.
Yeah, it did. I mean, there was never no doubt in my mind that I wasn't coming back, you know. I mean, I knew I was coming back. I had that belief, faith.
Did you really?
You know, there was faith there that I would get back. You know, yeah, I was scared. But I just had a feeling I'd get back.
Well, tell me, you mentioned faith. I mean, where were you spiritually? Was this something that was a part of your life at this point?
Not a lot, but, you know, when it got down to it, you know, I did pray. I mean, you know, I made a deal with God. You know, God kept His deal. I didn't.
What was the deal you made?
I get back. I'd do right. I'd live my life right.
Right.
If He'd get me through it. But like I said, there was a little faith there. You know, like growing up, you know, we weren't forced to go to church. My mom went to church. And, you know, we went to church a little bit, but we weren't required to. You know, once we got teenagers, and didn't really have any time for church. But, you know, the orders for Vietnam kind of threw me closer to God for a little bit.
So. Yeah. Did that stay with you while you were in country?
No.
Okay. All right.
I mean, on occasions, you know, but no. It didn't really stay. I mean, I didn't sleep at the foot of the cross.
That's an interesting way to put it. Okay. Well, tell me about leaving the United States and going to Vietnam. Where did you depart from and what did you fly over?
Flew out of Travis there, went to the Oakland Army replacement thing or whatever there, and was there like a day and a half or so, like the last 24 hours you're in this room, and, you know, you go there and they take your clothes and give you 5 new sets of jungle fatigues, and it's like in that room, you know, to make phone calls, but couldn't leave it in the big room there with bunks, you know, it was all in there. And, so, got jungle fatigues and stuff, and then on a bus out to Travis Air Force Base. And, of course, most everybody was, you know, cocky and gung-ho, not gung-ho. It was a light mood, you know, everybody was kind of going to Vietnam, big deal, you know.
Yeah.
But there was one or two kind of down, you know. We left Travis and we landed in Honolulu. It was on a commercial flight, TWA.
Yeah.
And we got off the plane in Honolulu. I think we hit the bar.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. I don't think we did there. But anyway, we stopped there. We was there, you know, for a couple, 3 hours. Then we stopped at Wake Island. For a little while, and then from Wake to Guam. Yeah, I think we got on from Guam right into Pont de Neuf there.
Okay. Do you remember the mood on the plane when you left Guam and that was your last stop and going into Vietnam?
It wasn't as noisy as when we left Travis.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, this is like a 17, 18, 19 hours, you know.
Yeah.
Been going. Yeah. It was pretty quiet.
What was it like flying into Ponsonant? Can you describe that? Do you remember?
Can't really remember too much.
Was it daytime or nighttime?
It was daytime.
Mm-hmm.
It was daylight. We got off there into buses, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was hot.
Yeah.
I hate it. You know what I mean? It was hot and humid. And the big buses, you know, they had the bars over the mesh over the windows and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, got on a bus there and went to the replacement battalion or something there. That's up in Long Bend, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or Ben Wall, I don't know if it's Long Bend or Ben Wall or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And put there at the replacement thing.
Did you know exactly where you were going, which unit, or
no.
Were you waiting? You were waiting for your assignment?
Waiting for assignment, and I don't know, it was there probably 2 days or so, and in the meantime there, because like I say, going over there was probably 10 or 12 guys I went through training with on the plane that I knew, you know,
mm-hmm.
And while there, I lost contact with all but one other guy that we went through training,
mm-hmm.
And but we got orders for the same battalion.
Really?
Yeah. 3rd 21st of July.
Mm-hmm.
So there we were. They bust us back out to the airport and put us on a C-130. While I was there, standing there, I remember looking at this guy, Air Force guy, and he's on a forklift loading a plane. That guy looks familiar,
mm-hmm.
And it was a guy I graduated with.
From high school?
From high school.
Okay.
He had joined the Air Force, and there he was, you know, working there. And I hollered at him, got to talk to him, and he got off the forklift and came over and got to talk to him about
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Went nowhere to head and said, heading up north to July, and he says, oh, you poor son of a bitch. You don't want to go up there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Says, okay.
But, why did he say that, do you know?
I guess because it's further north, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you heard rumors that they got overrun, like, last week or something,
mm-hmm.
You know, which maybe a fire base did, but, you know, in our mind, we was all thinking of July itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got on a C-130, which is the first time I was ever on one of them.
What was that like?
Well, that was scary.
Why?
I couldn't see out.
Uh-huh.
I strapped in a little nylon webbing seat. It had, you know, two rows down the side and two rows back-to-back down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had the duffel bag with the stuff with it, you know, which was all of our fatigues and wasn't
mm-hmm.
not much of any personal gear. I had that all in the duffel bag. And,
mm-hmm.
And it closed up. It was noisy and rough riding. Couldn't see out. So it was kind of scary, but kind of exciting, too.
Yeah.
So we landed at July, and I think we went on a deuce and a half. When no buses there, there's trucks.
Right. Right.
So they trucked us to the Maricow Replacement Center, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And,
where was that? Do you remember?
It was there at July.
Okay, at July.
And wound up, of course, really, I guess I didn't know what unit or anything we were going to go to,
mm-hmm.
for sure, but it was there, and I think they had like a 3-day in-country training thing there, you
mm-hmm.
know, about the people and booby traps. And then they had some former Viet Cong give some, you know, help get them the classes and presentations and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was that like? That must have been strange for you.
Well, yeah, like I said, you know, it was a, I can't remember. One thing I do remember, like, you know, they had the construction area, you know, bleachers, like, down the sand thing, and we was up there, sitting there listening, and still listening to what the instructors were saying. Some of us, we had these M&Ms we was feeding to the lizards down below, watching them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, funny things you can remember.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's all kinds of lizards there, and some of them were parasites, you know, 18, 19, 20, you know, a couple feet long or so. But, you know, they give us the rudiment things, you know, like if you're waving at them, that means come here, you know. Like we wave somebody, you know, to them, that's a sign to come here. And like if we'd see two teenage males holding hands, we'd think they're queer, but that's not to them. Remember that. But and a couple little things like that.
Okay. What was it like with the men? I mean, were you all with new people going through this training? And
Yeah, it was all new people.
Are you bunking with them as well?
Yeah, it's just temporary bunks. And like I said, I can't really remember any one person from there. You know, of course, we were just together there about 3 or 4 days.
I'm wondering if people were saying, "Hey, you know, Eichhorn, you know, let me tell you what's going on here, or you better watch out, or here's the deal," you know, anything like that.
Well, once I got to my unit, there was a lot of that.
Okay.
Once I got to the unit, there was a lot of that, but you know, like I said, we was all newbies. And,
yeah.
And they was telling us things to watch out, you know, the instructors too. Like I said, most of us was distracted by the lizards. And
right. Well, tell me about getting to your unit. What was that like?
That was an experience. Left July on my truck up through up Highway 1 through Tam Key. And, you know, that was really the first seen any village people. Everybody else, all the other Vietnamese we've seen were on the army compound, you know. And, you know, it's weird seeing how they lived. Different.
Yeah. What do you remember seeing?
Just dropping their drawers and going right ditch by the side of the road.
Yeah.
You know, and that. That's basically it. It was the biggest shock, I guess.
Yeah.
Then we got to Hawk Hill, and from there went on a Chinook, the double-bladed helicopters. Of course, we called them shit hooks. They weren't fun to ride on. They were kind of like C-130s, noisy and rough.
Yeah. Did you say Hawk Hill?
Hawk Hill, yeah. It was a
H-O-P?
Pardon?
H-O-P as in Papa?
Hawk at the hotel.
Oh, Hawk, right.
H-A-W-K, Hawk.
Gotcha, Hawk. Okay. That's for my transcriptionist right there. Okay. That's for the person who's going to be transcribing. I wanted them to be sure to spell that correctly and be able to understand it. Okay, so you get on the Chinook and you're out to your unit.
Out to LZ Center.
Okay.
And so, you know, of course, there's, I don't know, probably 15 or 16 guys, you know, we're all new seeds. And, there's me and one other guy, Don, he was in Staines. He was the other medic, so we got sent to the aid station. And then, I don't know, the other guys, what their MOS is, whether it's infantry or, you know, they went somewhere else.
Right.
And so we got to the aid station and checked in. And, was there, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. They said, you know, it'd be assigned to a flying company. And first night there, they said they need someone at the battalion, you know, where the radios.
Mm-hmm.
Need the Medicare for the night. I was it. All I had to do was just, my old man slept there at PTOC instead of on the bunkers there at the aid station.
Mm-hmm.
Just right there on the power bay.
Mm-hmm. What unit was this, Dave?
This is 3rd 21st, 196th.
Okay.
Off LZ Center at the time.
Okay.
Which is the power base, you know, had the artillery there.
Mm-hmm.
And mortars, and usually a line company would be on bunker guard around the far base,
mm-hmm.
and the other three line companies would be out in the field. There's four line companies, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Delta,
mm-hmm.
and Echo Company was a recon, they had a recon platoon, that was the mortars.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, this wouldn't be too bad duty staying here because they had a mess hall on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And they had nice, nice. They had bunkers built. And I mean, compared to some places, I wound up later.
Right. Nice. Well, describe the nice bunker for in Vietnam. What was it like for you?
Well, it had a wooden bunk with a air mattress.
Mm-hmm.
And had a few rats.
Yeah. Well, I've heard about the Vietnam rats. Tell me about them for you. What were they like?
They didn't bother me. Like I said, you know, I grew up on farms, mm-hmm. always around rodents. You know, some rats were bad. You know, you killed them and went on. But remember, this was one of the bunkers down on the bunker line. I woke up, I was sleeping on my stomach with my hands above me,
mm-hmm.
and I looked up, and there was a rat right on my arm. That's what woke me up.
Wow.
But, you know, they're just rats.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a relatively comfortable mattress, a nice wooden bunk.
And dry.
Okay. How many men in there with you?
There was four or five. Usually four, I think four in that bunker. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was built sandbag nice. And, you know, felt safe there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how long did you stay there at LZ Center?
I think it was about 3 days.
Okay.
And they said I'd go out to the resupply bird and go to Charlie Company.
So that's, you were attached to Charlie Company?
Yes.
Okay.
So,
This is going to be your first time going out into to the bush. How are you feeling?
Well, like I say, I was scared, but I was okay. I mean, you know, after, you know, I've been country now, what, 10 days, 2 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And talking, you know, the guys were friendly. They're at the aid station, and, you know, you know, I really wasn't excited about going out. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I really wasn't dreading it like I was when I first got my orders, you know,
mm-hmm.
to go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said, it's neither excited nor dreading it.
What did you have with you? Describe your uniform. What would you typically carry with you into the field as a medic?
Okay, and, well, those five new sets of fatigues they gave me in California?
Yes.
Once I got to Vietnam, that's the last I seen them.
Okay.
They, you know, we went out with the fatigues on, you know, pants, jacket,
mm-hmm.
T-shirt, and towel, two pairs of socks.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't wear any underwear.
Okay. Why not?
Bunch up and
mm-hmm.
sweat and, I mean, just something they didn't need.
Okay.
And I had an M16. Carried one bandolier of ammo. Had my aid bag. I think it had 2 or 4 pints of saline IV solution.
Mm-hmm.
Numerous bandages, morphine. Numerous pills, a lot of macerations they have, stuff with the, I mean, any cut, scratch, infected in a minute, I mean, in the jungle. I mean, that's, you don't realize how much dirt's there until you're there living in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, plus my sea rations for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had 5 quarts of water, 5 canteens.
Okay.
I carried a heavy rucksack.
Yeah. Well, how much do you think your whole rucksack and your uniform and everything weighed? What were you humping out there, weight-wise?
I was probably right at 100 or 90 pounds, I'd say. Maybe, I don't know, maybe 80 to 100 somewhere, depending on the water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes I did carry 6 quarts of water.
Well, it's hard for people to realize nowadays how heavy that is and the climate in which you're in, and also the terrain, and you're in a war zone. I mean, how do you do that physically?
Well, I just turned 20. I was 20 years old. and like I said, you know, I was in good shape physically. I mean, basic put me in the AIT. There wasn't much PT, but, you know, I was in physical good shape.
Mm-hmm.
I just did it. But like I said, when I went out with the resupply bird,
mm-hmm.
Of course, the medic that was there, he could have jumped on the plucked bird and got back to LZ Center, but he stayed with me 3 days.
Why did he do that?
Break me in, and they just hit the ship the night before booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing we did, because we hit one the next day, or they, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Got to treat my first casualty the next day, so it's a good thing he was there.
What did he tell you before the casualty came in that next day? What was he doing to prep you? Was he saying, okay, here's the most common kind of wound, or what did he tell you? Do you remember?
I can't remember exactly what he said, other
right.
than, you know, that one thing he did say, don't get close to anybody.
Why did he say that?
If they get it, it affects you. You lose it. I mean, that's one thing he did say, yeah, don't get close and real pals. Because, you know, if something happened to them, it, you know. I mean, this is jumping on ahead, you know.
Go ahead.
I didn't cry for the losses for 22 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you get close to some people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, how could you not?
I know.
So.
What enabled you to do that after 22 years?
I quit self-medicating after 22 years. That's when
okay.
I get.
Okay.
So, but, you know, if you got, if you got emotional, you couldn't do your job. And you know, like I said, he got there, was scared. Then there was a period from like about 2 months to 7 or 8 months. You know, it didn't mean, don't mean nothing, just didn't care, you know.
Was that what you all would say?
Yeah, our biggest things don't mean nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you knew better?
Pardon?
You knew better inside?
Well.
Or did you, were you really able to turn that stuff off?
I was able to because I went through it and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess deep down somewhere in my subconscious, you know, you know, it's taught not to kill and all this stuff. And,
right.
And I don't know if you could do it. It was a rush, okay?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've, I mean, talked to anybody, but there's a period in there that it was, for lack of a better word, it was a rush. I mean,
to be in a firefight?
To kill. Well, I never got into the killing. I mean, mm-hmm. I was a medic. I kept my head down. But mm-hmm. the guys would get the body count, and it was all right. You know, just like, I mean, I don't want people to judge me here, but if you just like, you know, scoring a touchdown in a football game.
Right.
I mean, as far as this or that, hated the Vietnamese. I called them dinks, or I called them dinks. I didn't care for them. But then there was another side of them, too.
You what?
There was the other side, too. They were human beings. You know?
Right. Well, these are the bad guys, and you guys are hunting bad guys.
Yeah. Well, and were they really bad guys? I mean,
well,
I thought so at the time.
I was going to say, did you all believe that then, at the time?
At the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or I did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Why were they there? Because when you run into somebody, you know, it was supposed to be a free fire zone, of, you know, there'd be a mama song, three or four little kids, and, you know, BC crocodile papa song, you know, and he'd be there.
Mm-hmm.
He'd take pot shots at us later in the day. I mean, you know, but I guess this is where these people grew up and raised, and they didn't know anything different now. I don't know.
Right.
Do you
want to go back to that, the first casualty that came in? These are your first ones to treat in Vietnam. Do you remember that day? What happened?
They had a patrol out and they hit a booby trap.
Mm-hmm. What kind?
I think it was just like a grenade in an empty tin can that they tripped and pulled out. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was something that they tripped with the water, mm-hmm. A grenade somehow. And they weren't that far from our day logger.
Mm-hmm.
And so we run to them, the other medic and I, and, you know, three or four other, another squad. I mean, like, you know, we just didn't take over. I mean, we had some cover and support. And we got there, and the other guy, he took the first one, and I went up to this other, and that was the one, you know, had the sucking chest wound, which, you know, you got to seal off so it doesn't collapse. So the air gets in the lung. That's what's happening. You know, sucking air in, get it sealed, and we got a special bandage for that, and had it. And remember in my training, I mean, it was, I guess it did okay. And, you know, got the dust off in and got them out of there. Half hour, 40 minutes time or so.
Did you talk to him?
Yeah, he was talking and said, "Nah, you can be all right. You're gonna be all right. Just lay still, lay still.
Mm-hmm.
And, just lay still. You know, you got $1 million wound. You're going back to the world." So.
Mm-hmm. Was he able to talk back with you?
Yeah, he was talking low. And I think he may be dying. I don't know. It's just something, you know. I mean,
you didn't find out what happened.
No, I would say he did, because usually they come back and told me this one guy didn't make it. I think you kind of figured this is later on, but you know, I never heard any more about him. He didn't come back. A couple of the other guys, I guess it hit three of them. The other two guys,
mm-hmm.
were, that was a different incident. But there were, I think, three of them hit with that booby trap.
What, mm-hmm. did you, this is your first time, was it different than you thought it would be, or was it similar?
I don't know. I can't really describe it, because, you know, it's like when something happened, you know, like on that, it just react, and it's just like something takes over instinct. It's not instinct. I don't know. The adrenaline rush or whatever. I just can't have that good of memories of what happened at the time. I mean,
yeah. You just did what you were trained to do.
Yeah.
Where would you all walk? I mean, if you're out walking a trail, were you all spaced in, you know, throughout the company, or were you, you know, one with each platoon?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd, like, sometimes, very seldom we moved as a company, usually as a platoon. Mm-hmm. Like medic, I'd either be walking with either third or fifth, because it'd be the platoon leader and the RTO, and then me. Or, you know, I'd be either third or fourth, it seemed like, or third or fifth, because, you know, the RTO had to be by the platoon leader.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd space out, you know, say 20 feet, or try to. You know, once in a while we'd get punched up. We just try not to, well, we did move on trails, and old trails. And we walked through the rice paddies.
Yeah.
Instead of the dikes.
Can you describe, Dave, just looking at in general of your time there, out in the bush, what was your typical day like from morning to the dark and then back again?
I would get up in the morning. Like I said, it had daily naps on malaria pills, and hand them out to guys. And then on a Monday, you had the big yellow malaria pill that everybody had to take. But I had a daily one, too. And sometimes we'd stay in that logger and send out patrols. Sometimes we'd move to, move 500 meters or so and set up for the day and send out patrols.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I said, every guy had jungle rot that would be treated, mm-hmm. new bandages and new salve. I'd take care of them. Sometimes I'd go on patrols, sometimes I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I'd have a paperback book or something to read, or, we'd trade around the platoon, get different books to read, just lay around and play cards, play a lot of spades and hearts.
This is at night?
No, through the day.
Through the day.
If we wasn't out on patrol.
Okay.
Wasn't out on patrol. I know one squad went with him. So it kind of changed. When I first got there, was after body count.
After the body count policy was.
Yeah, was there to, to bring the war to them. And
mm-hmm.
then, when they started to pull people out.
Mm-hmm.
71, it seemed like it changed. I mean, plus, mm-hmm. any support we'd get, artillery or airstrike, we'd always get them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of changed from that to not being the last GI killed in Vietnam,
Do you remember about when this was, date-wise? You get there in August 70.
I would say it was like January or February of 71. I mean, maybe just me. I mean, like I said, they got there, we had some good guys, and, they went home, got different, guys go home, and maybe it was the different guys we got, I don't know, but mm-hmm. it seemed like it changed,
Mm-hmm.
Like, get back, I went on patrol with this one guy, and shake and bake squad leader with the NCO school. I mean, he was a draftee, but he went to the school and got sergeant stripes,
Mm-hmm.
And he was a squad leader, and he just went out from maybe 150, 200 meters and sat down. Said he wasn't going to look for trouble. And
This was in 71?
Yeah.
I imagine, did you all have a problem with that, or?
Not really. I mean... because I think the DC and the NBA, they knew who to, if you wasn't messing with them, they wouldn't mess with you, kind of like deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it never happened to me, but I heard another guy, they got the C8 out and stopped, and he thought it was their Kit Carson scout, and he waved at him, but it was a DC, and he waved back and disappeared.
Wow.
I mean, I know one time we was getting water,
mm-hmm.
and it was just me and this other rifleman there at last, we heard something in the bushes, It was in D.C. because we got fired on about 2 hours later. But, you know, it dawns back how many times you walk by somebody and, you know, they could have did you in.
Did you realize it then?
Not really. You know, it comes back to me now. You know, there's so many times, so many things could have happened and didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, went on patrol one time and found that there was one side of the tree had a mark on it. So the squad leader, he kept following that, and it led us to an NBA base camp. And there were just a couple workers there, and he got them, and they pulled us out. And, you know, the next day they pulled everybody out of there, and they took a battalion in there.
Mm-hmm.
And just like I said, man, you know, what, 7 or 8 guys in that squad, count me. And,
yeah.
Well, yeah. So they'd all been there.
Yeah.
So
your typical day is you went out on patrol. Were you walking with your M16 out, you know, patrolling with the company, or were you kind of hanging back, or wherever you were there?
When the squad on patrol, I'd be in that about, you know, towards the next to last.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd have my M16 and my small aid bag, which didn't have all my bandages, you know, no rucksack.
Mm-hmm.
And then early on, we'd go just with our Boonies hat, but there at last, we couldn't have it. Took our steel pots.
Mm-hmm.
Never did carry the black jackets, you know, but
mm-hmm.
it had the steel pods.
Tell me about your supplies in the field. Were you able to get your medical supplies and equipment as you needed?
Sometimes, you know, it did like run out real quick. And this is in honor of the Dust Off pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Brought one in at night. Right, it happened right at dusk. The other one guy, he didn't make it. The other guy did. And we got him, you know, got him on a dust off, which is a regular Huey bird.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we stayed right there. The next day, I said, well, I need some supplies here. And they sent him out on a loach.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we stayed right there so the LZ was still secure, you know. And I remember this, one of the pop smokes, and popped the smoke to bring the bird in. And this is Loach, and he says, you want me to land there? And the LT was on the radio, and he says, hey, we had a Huey in here last night. What's the matter?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, which Loach is a lot smaller bird. And,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Yes. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Dust Off pilots? Tell me about them.
Really didn't have any contact per se with them other than that, you know, they would come. They would come. I mean, even if, when the monsoons came and they were a bit like not fly.
Mm-hmm.
The dust off split.
Mm-hmm.
It's like during the monsoons, we was 5 days on 3 days rations. And then one time we was on LZ Center, and I don't know, Bravo or Delta Company or who, they was down at the bottom. We pumped sea rats down off the hill to them because they was out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the monsoons come, I mean, it was just, I don't know what it was after. The activity level went down. I mean, as far as the DC and NBA, when I was there during the monsoons, it didn't run into anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they were holed up too. But some guys get immersion put, skin come off with their socks, you know.
Gosh, they got that bad.
Mm-hmm. Right. Looking back, I can't believe how we lived. I mean,
how did you live?
Like an animal. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Slept on the ground. And, you know, just all you had was clothes on your back.
Mm-hmm.
But we was resupplied a lot better than the Vietnamese were.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, if we lost the war, I mean, I hate to be on their side because they brought shit on them. I mean, they took a kick in them. You can say what you want to do, or, you know, people about us losing the war, but, you know, I don't think we ever lost a battle, so
mm-hmm.
how can you lose the war? I mean,
mm-hmm. What were the worst wounds that you saw?
Traumatic opposite amputation, hitting a booby trap of some sort, blown into.
Mm-hmm.
Leg here. Other body parts over there.
Mm-hmm. How common was that?
A couple times.
What do you do with that? What kind of that situation? Are you talking to the guy saying, "Listen, here's what's happened," or do you say everything's okay?
Well, one time there wasn't nothing to say. The other time was. Just hang on.
Mm-hmm.
And died. Knew he wasn't going to make it, and the other guy was screaming, so I just dropped him and went to the other guy. I mean, because just everything waist down was gone. And, I mean, not that he just. Nothing good to done.
What happened that day? Do you remember the incident?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to talk about it or not?
Yeah, we can. And it looked, you know, and he's listening on the ball as non-hostile, you know, I made some peace with it. We was together company-wise. This was right before I got out of the field.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Had a new platoon leader. And you need to separate, you know, but he was dumb and lazy. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but even a couple of squad leaders said we shouldn't longer here, we should move on to get some separation from the other platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but he said, I will longer here for the night. The one squad set went out. We'd set out mechanical ambushes, which is a booby trap, claymore with the tripwire.
Mm-hmm.
And the one squad leader sent a couple guys out to set one up on the trail, so we come in through a longer one. And,
mm-hmm.
and they hit one on the first platoon and put out.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God they had the angle low. Where it had two guys killed.
This was friendly fire, basically.
Yeah. I think started eating some pork slices on the sea rat and when they hit it. And Ray said, come on, Doc, we got to go get them because you could hear them screaming. Yeah, like I said, they weren't. But 80 meters from us or under. It wasn't far. We got right to him.
Mm-hmm.
Mike was still alive. He says, Doc, you got help. Him hurt bad. And he just went shocked. And I looked. And basically, he's bloating too from, you know, his legs are gone. And testing.
You knew this guy?
Yeah. Yeah, his death been for 3 years.
I'm sorry, Dave, what'd you say?
And Matt, his death stayed with me for a few years.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, I just laughed it off and went and worked on Don. I mean, and Don made it. I mean, you know. He had some pretty severe wounds on his legs, but they're all low. And, it like I said, it stayed with me. This took me 22 years to cry for his death. And I don't know why his death bothered me so much. Other than that, looking back, since I found out now, he was only 18.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I knew he was young, but then, you know, I thought he'd be 19. You're younger than me, but he was still 18.
Mm-hmm. How well did you know him? Was this someone, this was toward the end of your tour there. Had you guys hung out?
We drank a few on stand down.
Yeah.
Kingston down Kentucky, kind of like a hillbilly probably for me. He wasn't closest bud, but he got close to a lot of the guys.
And tell me, what was the most common thing you had to treat on a day-to-day basis? Was it jungle rot or something else?
Jungle rot, because any cut, it gets infected with the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's high humidity, high temperature, every bacteria, it's a their paradise there. And plus, mm-hmm. It stands so dirty, because there's very little ways to keep clean.
Mm-hmm.
The jungle rot was the most.
When you lost people in the field that you were trying to treat, how many times did that happen?
It was twice that I know of.
That you were actually actively treating?
Mm-hmm.
Did you take that personally?
Well, stuff that went on. It ate at. Well, still, not so much today, but it was always there. I used a lot of dark humor to get it, and I self-medicated with alcohol through the years
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
They're
in the field. Did you know that you were doing everything you could, or did you always feel like you could do something else?
Always felt that I could do something else. Or
mm-hmm.
Somebody else could have done a better job, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling that I had. But always had the feeling that somebody could do a better job,
So that feeling never left you? The one that you had during your training?
Not really. It's abated today, but, I've done some more film in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did best good for what I could there.
Mm-hmm. So you've come to terms with that now?
Yeah. Pretty well come to terms with, mm-hmm. I did the best I could for a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Dave, do you want to talk about those two times when you did lose somebody you were working on?
I think I just did.
Okay, that time?
No, the other one, it was, I'd say you just throwed stuff on the poncho and went out. Didn't really know them. Booby trap. But like I said, Mike, I knew him. Got to hear his last words.
Mike's?
Yeah.
What did he say to you?
Help me, Doc. I'm hit bad.
Did he realize how bad he had been hit?
Yeah, I think so. And then another guy in his squad told him, a couple weeks before he had a dream, and he was telling him that he wasn't going back. I'm sure you've heard the story, people saying they're not coming back, and, self-fulfilled prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
He told me that a couple weeks afterwards. I had to blame the team leader for not doing his job right, through the years, but I let that slide now.
Mm-hmm. What about this other time, besides Mike?
It really doesn't affect me like Mike. Not much to say.
What happened?
I stepped on some kind of booby trap. I don't know what it was, but it was an artillery round or something, you know. They would lug old dud arty rounds around and bury them. Sometimes they'd go off or something. I don't know. Really what kind of booby trap it was.
What kind of wound did he have?
He was basically dismembered like Mike, except of course.
Okay. Worse meaning he died right then.
Yeah, he never knew what he was going to
do. Okay.
Okay. It was pieces thrown on a poncho, you know.
Okay. I see.
And, you know, a lot of guys did that. I mean, 3 or 4 guys picking up pieces.
Were you ever wounded, David?
No, when no shooting was going, I had my head down low. As a matter of fact, I only fired my weapon one time at Vietnamese, and that was the choice I wouldn't have had to, and it was wasted. They got away. We took a break. We was marching. We was moving. And it took five. And of course, you always bunch up, you know. And it was probably 5 feet apart along the trail. It was dike-like. And the guy up in front of me, there was 3 of them. They bopped right up out of the dike area. And he was there, and he said, "Dig." And there's about, I don't know, probably 10 or 12 of us jumped up, and they went out across the thing there, and all of us firing at them, and they got them.
You didn't hit any of them?
Nobody hit any of them.
Wow.
So.
Okay.
Which is, kind of, it's not funny, but it is funny.
Right, I understand.
Okay.
Dave, was there any tension in the field between those enlisted and drafted versus those who were, lifers, basically, in the Army as a career?
Not in the field. In the same way, like race, you know, we had blacks in the field. There wasn't none, but you get back in the rear, there was.
Can you tell me about that? What did you see?
Or
hear? Or do?
Oh, okay, well... there in July, you know, the stand down thing, which like every, I think it was 12 weeks or 16 or 15 weeks, we get like 3 or 4 days in July there to re-zero weapons and whatnot. It amounted to a 3-day drunk for me, or some of us. And Vietnam was the first time I ever smoked any marijuana. I mean,
yeah.
I suppose it was around back then, but it wasn't here. I mean, so I was smoking some, and it wound up in with a group of blacks, and they took my lighter, and I run from them. Then another time, a group of 3 or 4 blacks, they showed up just as late. We was drunk, and they beat the heck out of a couple guys.
Was it just a group of them, or how did that operate? Would they walk around together, and you all would walk around together, or
in the rear? Yeah, but out on the far base and in the field, there wasn't no racial tensions or nothing against the lifers. There was a little bit in the rear, but not in the field. I mean, of course, maybe we had the pretty good lifers. You know, I remember the one stand down. Of course, they come out with, like I said, we had to give up all our new fatigues. they'd have what we call lifer clothes, you know, had their name and insignia, had their own clothes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Captain McGee, he come out and he had his new clothes and everything on, so I just poured a beer right off. So the eggs took them pretty good
mm-hmm.
after a while. So.
Okay.
Man, we got along pretty good. But in the rear, there was some racial tension and some lifer tension.
Yeah. How about tension between those who were permanently stationed in the rear and those who were, you know, like you all, out in the field and back and out back out of the field? Did you all have any kind of feelings toward them or them towards you?
Well, it was just good-natured rimps, you know.
Uh-huh.
We don't call them all rimps. But, see, that was the deal, get your rear job, you know, get out of the bush. It was all, at least on my part, was all in fun. Most of what I've seen was calling them rimps was in fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just part of the nature of it.
Did they think, tell me about you all? Were they... you know, particularly critical of you all or anything like that?
Pardon?
Were they critical of you all, the people who were out in the field?
No, not to recall. I know. Well, see, one time, this was the Da Nang, what they did. They sent the Maricao home there in what, 70 or whatever, mm-hmm. supposedly, or 71.
Mm-hmm.
But they gave the LZ Center to the Arvins. And we moved up and took over a Marine AO. They sent the Marines home.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this one PX, it wasn't at Freedom Hill, but another one there at Da Nang. They wasn't going to let us in because we didn't have proper uniforms on.
Hmm. Wow.
And I don't think we did get in, if I remember right. You know, there was some bullshit there in Da Nang.
What kind?
Like that there, you know, we weren't in proper uniform. And I think there at that one compound, they wanted to salute the officers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't salute them, you know, in the field.
Why didn't you all salute them there?
Well, somebody watching to figure out which one was the officer, you know, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, never really, in the field, it's a whole lot different. I mean, and, you know, it's, basically, well, of course, remember, like I said, I was the medic, I was in the CP, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just about get down on first thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lieutenant, you know,
mm-hmm.
some of them, but, yeah, his ass is out here on the line, too. I mean,
right.
More so than a lot of the other riflemen.
Would that invoke more respect for those who actually would go out in the bush versus those who would stay back at the base camp?
It might. It's hard for me to say. Can't really say for sure.
Okay. Did you ever hear or see any incidents of bragging?
No. Never heard of it. We had one CO one time that someone offhandedly made this comment about bragging, but no, it didn't. It just didn't happen. Didn't happen in my unit. When I was there, put it that way. I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it happened. Mm-hmm. I can see where it happened.
Overall, Dave, how would you rate the equipment that you had, the medical equipment? Was it adequate for the job? Or and also your military equipment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was adequate, I guess. Like I said, the M16 to me seemed like, you know, I was much more comfortable with an M4. M14 seemed more like a rifle to me than an M16, but it's what I grew up with, you
mm-hmm.
know. The M16 was light, too light, and too much like a toy, but like I said, we had a lot better equipment, and Vietnamese.
Was there any piece of medical equipment that you wish you had that you did not have?
Not that I can recall. Just wish I had more knowledge.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes there's nothing more you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Got to remember that.
What was the most feared weapon from the other side?
Probably the AK-47.
Yeah? Why?
I don't know. I don't know why it would be. Because, you know, most of our casualties were booby traps.
Why don't we break this for a moment? This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project with Mr. David Eichhorn. Today's May 5th, 2005, and it's 1:35 p.m. Central Standard Time, and I am in Lubbock, Texas, once again. And Dave, you are in Fleming, Ohio. Why don't we talk a little bit about some general issues that you had to deal with, I guess, constantly, and that's the enemy. I wonder if you could make some general comments on what you thought while you were over there about the North Vietnamese Army, the Viet Cong, and other things, or other ways that the enemy could be present, such as booby traps and things like that. But what were your general impressions of the enemy?
Well, kind of hard for me to say. They were, they weren't dumb, but they were kind of creative in their booby traps and stuff.
Yeah.
They were hardcore, and, they lived a pretty rough life.
Mm-hmm.
As far as their supply was seen, and, they were under-supplied, and...
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I was there in the late in the war, and they were understaffed too. We never run into anything like you did in Teta 68.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I mentioned before, the majority of our wounded were by booby traps, and they stayed out of sight.
Right. So the stereotype or the general idea that they kind of would do hit and run tactics, was that consistent with what you saw?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wouldn't come out and fight. They would hide, and of course they were there.
Right.
But never seen them, and for me, being a medic, anytime there were any shooting, I was always down. I couldn't tell where the fire was coming from or nothing,
Mm-hmm.
So, they were hid. They'd like to use snipers a lot, One sniper would hold up the whole platoon the whole day,
How could that happen? What would happen in that situation?
They'd stop moving and set up kind of like a temporary perimeter or something, and send out a patrol to try to find the sniper. And, I'd just be a squad or so, and the rest of the platoon would just be hanging around the day longer,
just waiting to see if they could find him.
There's just a lot of boredom and waiting.
Really? So the hurry up and wait thing is the saying of the Army? Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. What would you say was the biggest strength of the enemy?
Well, it was their country, I guess. Their biggest strength, they spoke the language. They would, if there was any peasants living there, they would scarf them up and have them walk point too.
Yeah.
Same as we would.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd know, where the booby traps are or should.
Right.
So, but I guess their strength was, their country, and I guess we were the outsiders.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think were the major weaknesses? I guess you touched on those, the supply problem.
yeah, the supply and the under, you know, they didn't have the material that we had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our supply was much, and firepower was much greater than theirs.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that firepower did to them psychologically? I mean, was that something that you think was very effective, or was that something that, you know, as far as what the enemy saw and felt, it wasn't effective?
It was effective, then it wasn't. I guess, you know, they'd become used to it.
Right.
You know, they had their tunnels and bunkers to, you know, where they, you know, they dug in where it really had minimal effect on them, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there, actually, I've heard that from veterans before, that you can kind of get used to the noise and the bombing and, you know, you're hearing it. Is that true?
Yeah, it's, you know, it just was for me. Like I say, it just got in with it and, you know, went with it. And like I said, I think I've touched on it before, there's, you know, the middle months of my tour that, you know, it just, I don't know, just become animal-like, I guess. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter. Kind of hard for me to describe.
Yeah. What would you say was the most feared weapon that, from your standpoint, looking at the United States military forces and what you saw on the field, what was the most feared weapon that the enemy had?
Anything, I guess. I mean, like I said, most of our casualties were the booby traps. Like I said, mortars and rockets, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dave, how would you rate, when you were in the field, the communication that went on within your unit and the communication between, you know, your leaders there in the field and back to the base camp?
You know, we had to prick 25 radios, I mean, and sometimes it's piss poor.
Yeah? How so? What would happen?
I don't know, if we'd be down in the jungle, a low spot, couldn't get out. I remember guys climbing up the trees trying to talk to, you know, higher. But, you know, we had good communication when the planes were there, I mean, and the helicopters. But sometimes it'd be, there were some problems establishing communications by radio, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What about intelligence? Do you think you guys had good intelligence? Mm-hmm. Or was it, or, you know, how did you use it?
Well, like I said, from my viewpoint, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't think we had real good intelligence. Maybe, you know, the powers to be might have had, but, you know, down where we was at, or where I was at, I couldn't really, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah, you just,
or where we was going or anything.
Was it a day-by-day war for you, Dave, or were you guys able to look at the kind of the bigger picture?
No, it was just a day-by-day, counting the days to get the 365 in and get home.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a calendar at any point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a short-time calendar.
Yeah? What'd yours look like?
It was just a sheet of paper, and had the days, and when the day was over, I'd mark it out and color it in. Then some people would put it, draw it in their lining on their steel pot, you know, and like I said, a lot of guys, this is spring 71, we're getting, you know, like 30 and 60 and 90 day drops.
Right.
You know, and that was, so some guys was going home early, and, You know, that picked my spirits up, but...
Seeing them go home? Or being the chance to go home?
The chance that, you know, I might be going home early, but wound up staying the full year.
Right.
And, you know, some guys extended, but I'm one that, you know, they would get discharged when they come back.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had extended 42 days, but I didn't want to transit, but, you know, anything could happen anywhere. I mean, you know, a rocket or mortar or anything.
Right. How was your morale over there, Dave, personally?
I was down to begin with, then it was kind of up and, you know, kind of outstanding for a while, and then, you know, it'd go up and down.
Yeah. What would make it go up and down? What kind of things would affect it?
Oh, it's hard to say. You know, somebody getting hurt would put it down. We get some body count, that'd put it up.
Right. What did you think of the body count policy? And did you think that it was, you know, how did you guys work it there in the field? But what did you think of it overall?
Well, I thought it was kind of a physical way to keep score. Some of it was overinflated and some of it was under, you know, you had to have the body.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times there'd be some blood trails and, you know, they couldn't make it, but, you know, it still wouldn't count.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I kind of think, I guess the Rock Marines, they didn't take body count, so I kind of agree with the way to do. Just, you know, don't take it because it's, like I said, some of it I think was overinflated too.
Really? Did you ever see that yourself?
No. No, not my unit. But then again, it might not have been. That's just...
Okay. Well, what did you think of the South Vietnamese military forces, the ARVN and other units?
Well, I didn't think much of them, but I wasn't around them much after, like, you know, we kind of hated the Vietnamese. It's like in a little village, Nui Lop Son, right down from the fire base. There was a guy, he got him a rear job, and he was like, liaison between the PFs there and, mm-hmm. you know, and the fire base and whatnot. And we come through there, and got to talk to him, and his whole idea of the Vietnamese had changed, you know, because he was spending a lot more time with them, you know. And
mm-hmm.
So, but from my personal point, from what I've seen, I didn't think a whole lot of them. But like I said, I wasn't with them much. I mean, we had a couple Kit Carson scouts.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was outstanding, and the other ones were, you know, I just kept my eye on them. I didn't trust them.
Uh-huh.
But, like I said, it wasn't too high, mm-hmm. in my opinion, I guess, as a whole. But, like I said, I wasn't around them much.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the Kit Carson scouts.
Mm-hmm. They were, you know, former VC who come to the Arvin side, and
mm-hmm.
they'd be like interpreter and, you know, help us out.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, most couple of them, they were just there. They really didn't do much. And one of them, he was pretty well gung-ho. He'd get out walk point, and he could be pretty rough on some peasants when they... And he interrogated them too. But.
How so? What do you mean?
Well, I see him online get a little physical with an old Amazon because she wasn't telling him the truth, he said.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he would be a little physical toward it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they never did say it. Tell him anything, I don't think, but...
Yeah.
like I said, we had one that was pretty good, and the other two we had were just there, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Dave, if you don't mind, and you don't have to talk about this, but I'd like to know how your, or just about some of the things personal to you when you were there. First of all, your spiritual beliefs. Can you comment on anything that happened in that sense to you in Vietnam? Did the war there change or alter your spiritual beliefs, if you had them at all?
Yes and no. I mean, it kind of made me more cynic, I guess, it's kind of hard, basically just stuffed a lot of feelings and stuff and never shared with anybody and just stuffed it up, went on, did best could, I did pray on a daily basis.
Did you? What you said? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But didn't let anybody see it. But
yeah.
Why
not?
It just seemed kind of hypocritical, praying for good things and turn around trying to kill.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just kind of like I can't explain it. It's just feeling one thing and doing the exact opposite, I guess.
Did you feel that you would be looked down upon if you were caught praying or if you admitted spirituality or your spiritual interests?
Yeah, I think, looked at that same way as like if you break down and cry when somebody gets killed or something, it wasn't macho, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or in my case, I feel if I did let down, I could never regroup,
So you felt like you had to stay strong the whole time and not let yourself get, soft?
Yeah.
Was this stuff ever spoken about, or was just the expected behavior? You guys would not cry over fallen comrades, and you would stay outwardly strong?
I was just kind of unspoken. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen. Or...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Like I said, it just wasn't spoken about. Went on,
Mm-hmm.
Use a lot of, dark humor, I guess, gallows humor, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the humor. How would that, what role did humor play for you in Vietnam?
Well, it kept me from going crazy, I guess.
Yeah?
it kind of lightened up a real dark situation.
Mm-hmm.
We had one guy, was in a night logger, and a PC come in, he hollered at him, he turned, and he shot him, but we didn't find him till the next day,
mm-hmm.
And of course, he'd shot him right high and right up, mm-hmm. Went up through the test, and got him, and he was feeling kind of bad, he was there, squad leader, and five or six of us there looking at him next morning, and the other guy said, "Well, when we get back to July, he's going to have him write on a blackboard 100 times, I will not shoot dinks in the ass anymore." he did feel, he felt bad, I think, but, broke the spell and went on. Just little silly, stupid things like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me any examples besides that one? What do you remember? What do you see in your mind's eye when you think about humor in Vietnam? What are you thinking about now?
Well, about telling him when, it's right on the blackboard there, that and there.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of humorous. just a bunch of other silly things, like that one guy was, we had been hopping, I don't know, like 15, 20 clicks or so hot. We broke, and he took off his rucksack and stood up and says, "Thanks, we come in peace," you know, mm-hmm. or something.
Mm-hmm.
We're your friends, come on out,
mm-hmm.
or something. I mean, silly, stupid thing. I mean, I can't really tell the stories, you know. I mean, some guys can make a great big story out of it, but I can't.
That's fine, Dave. That's,
you know. But we did use humor.
Yeah.
And some of it was pretty sick humor.
Mm-hmm. But it got you through.
Right.
Can you comment on fear? How did fear play a role for you?
Kept me alert. And it was really, you know, the thing, it was really all in my mind. I mean, the fear was in, it was there. But when something happened, it was, I don't know, the adrenaline rush or whatever, the fear was blocked out. It just reacted, and I wasn't scared until afterwards.
Oh, really? After a firefight or after you got home to the United States?
Both.
Okay.
Both. But not the scaredest ever was once. I don't know. I didn't tell this earlier, did I?
I don't remember. I don't know what you're going to say.
Went out on a night ambush, and there it was, the pigs that heard something in the grass. I was on watch. There's three guys up by the trail road, and mm-hmm. two up in the back, and there's some pigs reaching around in there. And I could hear some movement, but I didn't hear them grunting or anything. And, you know, the fear in my mind started racing, and, you know, thought they were sneaking in. They seen us move in there at dusk, but here was pigs in there reaching around. So.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I said, most of the fear was when something wasn't happening. When something happened, somebody hit a booby trap, would go bandage them up. I wasn't scared, but afterwards I'd start shaking, you know, and be scared afterwards. But it seemed like when something happened, the fear wasn't there.
Right.
I mean, that's the best I can explain.
Right. That you said the time when you heard the pigs rooting around and all that. You said that was the most scared you'd ever been?
Yeah, because, you know, it was racing. My mind, I had time to think, and my mind was racing, you know. But as far as when something would actually happen, I don't know if the adrenaline rush would block out the fear. But, yeah, there was fear. You know, the worst part was when nothing. I mean, the fear was worse when something wasn't happening.
Right. That's interesting. It's ironic, you know, that people probably would think that you'd be scared maybe in the moment, but I guess you're thinking of survival and other things, doing what you need to be doing. What made you so scared that night with the pigs? Was it just because of the unknown, not knowing what's going on?
Yeah, the unknown and, you know, the time to think the worst, you know.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? I mean, what kind of effect does that have on a man? Every day, almost, I guess, having to deal with this kind of situation. Like you said, any time a rocket could come in, a sniper could shoot.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that?
I don't know. I was just young and dumb and dead. I can't explain it. You know, it's just like, you know, after you're there a while, you know, if you, like an arty round or an RPG or something, you know, if you hear it, it ain't going to, you know, it's the artery is by you. If it's going to get you, you know, it's traveling faster than the speed of sound. So,
mm-hmm.
so once you hear it, it's by you or it's not going to hit you. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, that's what they said, but I guess there's some truth to that. But, but early on, it would scare you, but there was a period in there that it didn't scare me.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got short, it scared me again.
Did you act differently when you were short?
Pardon?
Did you act differently when you were short?
Yeah, I went back out in the field when I was short for 4 days, and man, I was really up scared.
Really?
Yeah. But one thing that, you know, went with a bunch of guys, there's nobody left there that I knew that was in the field 2 months earlier, 3 months. And, you know, I was getting close, and all the horror stories you hear about people going, you know, 11 months and 3 weeks and then getting it.
Mm-hmm.
But I got through it. So.
Yeah, apparently you did. You did. Dave, what about bravery? What role did this play? Can you comment on that?
Didn't play much on mine, because like I said, when they're shooting down, I kept my head down. And, you know, I wasn't wanting to be a hero. And I think there was a couple guys that showed a lot of bravado and bravery. And we had a couple guys that were pretty good.
What do you mean?
As far as booby traps and, you know, seeing them before they'd hit them. And, and being good infantrymen, I guess.
Did you see men who were good soldiers by just natural instinct?
I think there's some that, you know, born to do it, and others just, like me, just, you know, stuck into it and doing basically the best he could at the time, I guess.
What made a good soldier, in your opinion?
One, didn't panic. Could put up with the bullshit and follow the good orders and kind of let a lot of the stuff slide off, you know, didn't get too upset. So it's kind of hard to say for me.
Well, Dave, let's talk a little bit about what you guys did when you were not out there you're walking the field or dealing with, you know, the sick or wounded. How did you entertain yourself? What did you guys do for entertainment?
I would drink and smoke dope every chance we got.
Really?
Except not in the field. Now, when we get on the fire base, they could usually get some beer. I don't remember. No, we didn't. I don't think we got much pot on the far base either. I remember, about back in July, there's always a bunch of marijuana and then some heroin. Some guys, dopers, got on it. Most of the guys didn't mess with it. Most of the guys would smoke, and drink.
You want to talk about what you did?
Well,
you don't have to. I mean, I'm just asking.
Yeah, I would. You know, anytime they would, once in a great while, they'd send us out beer and pop, you know. Maybe it'd be warm, but, you know, the guys that didn't drink beer, I'd drink their beer warm. And they had what we called stand down back in July every 6-8 weeks or so, which supposedly, you know, would re-zero weapons and this and that, and they'd put poor money and get poor shows. They had like a R&R, in country R&R rec center there. It balanced about a 3-day drunk for me. So.
Really?
Yeah, I just. And, let's see, you buy 2 fifths of whiskey. And then the EM Club, it was open. And you could drink there for from like 7 to 10 of the evening, or maybe it was 7 to 9, I don't know. Myself, I just tried to drink as much as I could to get where I wouldn't feel anything.
Did it work?
Oh, for a while. Worked for a few years after I come home, too.
Yeah. What about the drugs? What did you do, and what did you see most of all?
The only drugs I did was smoke some marijuana, but I've seen some guys get into heroin and stuff. I just kind of, you know, they run a different pack than what I was in. Seemed like the dopers and the drinkers didn't mix back in the rear.
Mm-hmm. What? So, go ahead.
You know, it's kind of like the whites and the blacks didn't mix in the rear.
Right. Yeah, we talked about the racism and the separation. Were drugs and alcohol ever a problem out in the field?
Not in my unit.
What would happen if someone brought out any dope out to the field?
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it'd be on the squad leader if he'd find it, or, you know, or... I don't know. Like I said, it never happened that I was aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you guys keep any pets with the unit?
No, but some people on the bar base there, there's a couple of them have a monkey and a couple of them have a couple dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't, you know, in the infantry company, none of us had any pets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How much contact did you have with home?
I got get a fair share of letters from parents and girlfriend, brother, sisters. They wrote a couple letters, so I had quite a bit of letter writing.
You did yourself?
Yeah. Wouldn't write much, but write a little bit.
What would you talk about in your letters?
Oh, how many more days I had left, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, might mention getting a rear job.
Would you tell them what was going on, really, how dangerous it was, or what kind of trouble you were in?
Just superficial stuff, like... You know, tell them about some of the wildlife things.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, I never got into any of the lawsuits or anything.
Why not?
Didn't really want them to know that. And, you know, if I started writing about it, I'd probably start feeling something.
Mm-hmm.
Just avoidance of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever make any Mars phone calls?
Yeah, I did make one Mars call. That was my sister. My dad was sick. Something about getting a compassionate reassignment or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I did make one call. And my oldest brother, he was home. He answered the phone then. Because, you know, it's morning in Vietnam, but it's evening back here.
Mm-hmm.
So I did make one Mars call. I know some people, they made quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to keep up with news from the United States?
Well, not really, looking back, except what was in the Stars and Stripes, but most of that was, you know, stuff happening over there,
mm-hmm.
if I remember. You know, once in a while somebody would send a clipping from home newspaper, but didn't really keep up on what was happening. Remember who won the Super Bowl and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. What did you find yourself missing most about the United States?
Well, indoor plumbing. real food to eat, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Real clothes. Sleeping in a bed. And...
all the basics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just electricity, I guess. Well, I guess we had electric on that far base.
Mm-hmm.
Just little, simple things. Cold water.
Cold water?
Yeah. drinking water.
I see what you mean, yeah. Okay.
Ice water. So.
What was the food that you guys were eating? Can you describe it?
Well, the sea rations were... I grew up with sea rations. Some of it was like the beanie weenie. It was good, man. But, you know, we'd get a case of them every 4 days, I think, or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And the ham and lima beans would pitch them. And
how come everybody pitched them? I keep hearing this over and over.
They weren't good. There was a time I wished we had some.
Yeah?
Yeah, we'd go, like the monsoons, we wouldn't get resupplied. Go, you know, 5 days, 6 days on 3 days rations. You kind of wish you had something to eat that fifth day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the pork slices were good.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. But like I said, they were nourishing, I guess. I survived on them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then they'd pick up, like, some wild bananas once in a while. Another kind of little fruit cross between an orange and a tangerine or something. I don't know what they were. Right. I ate a bunch of them one time, remember.
Right.
And then on the far base, they had a mess hall there, and they cooked, you know, food. Get hot food there. And then once in a great while, they'd send hot food out in the field, and these big cooler things. Very seldom. I think we only got them two or three times. One time we got the spaghetti. Everything had was, that's all we got, spaghetti, and somebody else, other unit, got all the sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So, but even when they did try to send us good food, they'd screw it up.
Okay. Dave, tell me about what you listened to as far as music was concerned. And what role did music play in Vietnam for you?
Mm. Well, we weren't supposed to have radios in the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a transistor. Sometimes the night longer with an ear jack, I'd turn it on.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I listened to country music, and I think they only had like an hour show of country music. Most of it was rock and roll,
mm-hmm.
which
so you were a country music fan?
Yeah, listened to that. I like on the far bass a lot of them. It had a reel-to-reel tape with a bunch of sounds on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'd crank her up on the far base.
Yeah.
Tape players and stuff.
Do you remember any of the songs that you like, that you listen to?
Oh, Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
I remember Edge Over Troubled Water. And Charlie Pride, he was big on the countryside. Jerry Reed and Van Anderson Rose Garden, I guess, was big in.
What was the most popular kind of music overall there?
The rock and roll.
Yeah.
And, like Simon Garfunkel, Clever Baby, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what was it? Indigato DeVito.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of them now. I can turn on the old time rock and roll, I can listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell, but... you know, Scott McKenzie, Flowers and Hair in San Francisco, that was big.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we got to get out of this place.
Mm-hmm.
But, that song was played quite a bit. I don't know, that was the animals that had that time. Hey.
What about R&Rs? Were you able to get one?
Yes, I was.
Tell me about that.
Oh, gosh. To be 20 years old in Sydney, Australia again.
All right.
So, yeah, I had to wait till when I had 10 months in country, because Sydney was one of the more popular ones, you know, I couldn't see going to Taipei or Hong Kong or Bangkok. I wanted to see around, so I spent a week down in Sydney. The Aussie girls, they liked the GIs. We had some money to spend, and we had fun.
What did you do? You knew what I was going to ask you, didn't you?
Well,
of course, you don't have to talk about it, Dave. But I mean, if you want to, for people to understand what you guys did on R&R in Australia.
Okay.
I mean, we can all use our imagination, but.
Okay. Well, I won't get graphic then. I'll share in general.
You go right ahead. Do whatever you want to.
Okay. It was a Red Garter at one bar. They had like a happy hour at 7 o'clock to 8. All the drinks were free.
Wow.
And about 7 o'clock. There'd be 50, 70 women hit that place, and by 9 o'clock it'd be empty, you know, kind of pair up or something. So I hooked up this one gal, we went to her place that night. She had good work. We did some drinking and dancing, and I think we danced. But I did some drinking anyway. So.
Yeah.
And so left her place that morning. She had to go to work, and I was supposed to meet her back there at night, but she didn't show. So hooked up with this other one and kind of spent the next 4 days. She came back to my hotel, and we kind of hung out. And went out to see the sights of Sydney and ate, you know, the big... at the time, it was the tallest building south of the equator and had a revolving restaurant in it. Went to the zoo, out across the harbor and stuff. And did write a couple letters after.
Yeah.
Come back and met to see it. But like I said, I wound up coming back with some money, but... you know, then other guys, I guess there were some prostitutes there, but I didn't get hooked up with them, but...
Didn't need it.
Well, no, because like I said, there's a lot of the Aussie girls, they like the GIs because they had money to spend. And, you know, it's been one night what the average Aussie guy would make in a week or more. So, so I guess they kind of like it.
That's fun. Well, that's definitely the PG version.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I guess we'll leave it that way.
Okay, that sounds fine.
So it was enjoyable. But...
Did it provide you rest and relaxation, recuperation? I mean, did you feel feel better when you got back?
Oh, I was so down when I got back. I mean, you know, even though it was, you know, it wasn't America, they talked a little funny, I mean, the weirdest things, like, I remember coming out of this bar there at night and looking up there and seeing this Kentucky Fried Chicken sign and just sitting down laughing like crazy.
Because, yeah.
You know, here we are and, you know, down under, and there's Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, so, and, it was just, I don't know, like I said, it's, instead of R&R, it was rest and relaxation, it was I&I, intoxication and intercourse for me, so, but once I got back, of course, I had my rear job, and, but, you know, it was a downer coming back in the country, but, you know, I only had, like, 6 weeks left, so...
You were still the A station medic. You're still working that.
In Da Nang. I was in Da Nang. I wasn't on the fire base.
Okay. Tell me about the transition. What happened? How did you get back to Da Nang?
Well, they sent some new medics over. So some of the guys that, you know, like Group Aussie and we wound up spending eight, 9 months in the field. They were only spending 2 or 3 and then getting rear jobs. So, you know, it's kind of like seniority. You got bumped from the fire base. Of course, like I said, they gave LZ Center to the Arvins, and we went to this other hill. And I don't think they had a full, yeah, there's some artillery there and mortars.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a flying company there providing bunker guard all the time like Center.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't as much need for as many, much support there as there was on Center. So a lot of us got back to the battalion, I guess, called Battalion Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, they sent a bunch of medics over. So basically, I'd work sick call, which was like from 7 to 9 in the morning. And that's all I'd have to work for the day.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
What'd you do the rest of the time?
Go up to the Freedom Hill PX, hang out up there. Like I said, the EM club wouldn't open up till 7 or evening, so, but I did some trading to get something to drink. And I'd read a few books, too.
Mm-hmm. This seems like a much better situation for you than what you had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It was, like I said, it was, well, in a way, it was good duty.
It was what?
In a way, it was good duty. Like I said, I only had to work 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I got drunk one night. And still drunk. We're still going out at 7 the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of frowned on that a little bit, but didn't get too much trouble.
Who frowned on it? The MPs?
No, the platoon sergeant.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, like I said, I could have gotten a lot more trouble there. Da Nang, I mean, with the booze and, you know, the drugs are there and boredom.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm. Did you miss being out there with the unit as far as the relationships with the men?
Looking back, I did, but I didn't realize it at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was something, you know, it was a change, something different. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, the guys that I was in the field with, all, you know, got new jobs. You know, there's new people out here.
Mm-hmm.
But see, I, like I mentioned earlier, I went out there with about 18 days left.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was the same company I was with before, but there wasn't anybody that I was in the field with 3 months earlier, mm-hmm. 2 months earlier.
Mm-hmm. Why would they send you out there that being that short?
Oh, well, it was like, you know, I was getting in trouble drinking too much, and like I said, I didn't show up for work that one morning. They frowned on that, so
mm-hmm.
I said, well, just send me back to the field.
And they did.
And they did. For 4 days.
For 4 days? And,
yeah.
And what happened?
Well, then the company come back because they was pulling bunker guard there and on the ridge line back of Da Nang. And so they... Soon so I was home to come back, and he sent another medic up with him. And I had to work, I think, one day, which, you know, worked the whole 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the time I was off, get ready to process out. So.
What did it feel like to, you know, to be going home?
Well, it felt great. And, yeah, it was great. But then, you know, once we got on the plane, there was kind of like a empty feeling in the pit of my stomach. It was, you know, it was on a plane load of strangers, not anybody to serve with or anything. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was, and then it did feel it was great, you know, but there was still something gnawing deep down. But looking back, it was just, you know, I wasn't coming home with somebody that I'd spent a lot of time with, you know.
Mm-hmm. Dave, a couple other questions. When you were coming back, a couple other questions before we talk about what happened when you got home. But what was that mood like on the plane? I mean, how do you leave a situation like that? What did you feel?
Like I said, it was elation. I was going home, but then again, there was a little empty feeling somewhere. I mean, but it was great. I mean, you know, going home, so
mm-hmm.
looking forward to it.
Were you scared in any way?
No, I wasn't scared, but there was a, you know, just a, I can't describe the feeling, just like a emptiness or something.
Mm-hmm. Why the emptiness? Was it, you felt you were leaving something behind, or?
I guess that's it. I mean, I can't really explain it, but, mm-hmm. you know, there was something, you know, it felt great going home. But also there was something that I can't describe it, other than, you know, kind of little empty twinge or something. And you know, from looking back, I think it's just because I wasn't coming home with any of the guys that I was there with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when you got back into the United States, how was your transition to life at home and being away and transitioning really into civilian life?
I guess, well, I did. Like I said, I got to come home and, you know, landed in McCord Air Force Base and then Fort Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And got home from you know, Seattle SeaTac Airport to Chicago to Columbus, and got home about 7 o'clock the next morning. From, you know, about 22 hours after I landed in country, I was in Columbus,
mm-hmm.
and my sister and girlfriend took me up to the airport, and I said, "Well, I want to drive, but let's get out of Columbus first." Because I hadn't driven in a year,
mm-hmm.
and so once I got out of Columbus, got behind it. Felt good to get behind the car and drive. Then come home, and you know, drove in, see Mom, my dad, and then partied for a couple weeks.
What did you say to your parents? Do you remember what they said to you?
Nah, but you can't really remember. I remember Dad meeting me at the back door. And, you know, more or less, I don't know, well, we didn't really hug, but just put our hand on each other's shoulders, I guess. Didn't really say a lot. But, you know, you know, he's glad at home.
Mm-hmm. So your dad didn't say too much?
No.
You said he was a man of a few words anyway.
Yeah, he didn't say much.
How about your mother?
Nah, she didn't really say a whole lot.
And was it like, welcome home, or was it, you know, I need some help out here with the hogs? But I mean, was it warm?
Yeah, it was in August.
Or was the mood warm?
Oh, the warm. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. It was. You know, they flat as home.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, didn't really ask any questions what I did, or just mm-hmm. glad to have me home.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I partied for 2 weeks and got married. And had to go to Fort Pope. And I was out Fort Pope for 2.5 months, and then they discharged me.
You had to finish up your obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who'd you party with?
Oh, just some locals down at the local watering hole, or anybody that would, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A couple of them was vets that did their tour a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
And did some drinking with my brother next to me.
Mm-hmm. Did people talk to you about Vietnam? Did they want to know?
No.
Why not?
I suppose just thought, I don't know. You know, if you didn't mention it, it didn't happen. But, you know, the mood was warm and everything. And, you know, I wasn't, like I said, when I got home there, I remember getting in the airport at Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Got in there like late, maybe midnight, 1 o'clock, about 20 minutes before the bar closed.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you were looking to drink when you got home.
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't going to deal with being sober in the United States at this point.
No.
Had people warned you and talked to you about maybe what might happen when you go home, or did you have any inclination about that?
No. No, there was nothing about what to expect when you get home, as I remember.
No decompressing or anything like that?
No. No.
Hmm.
But then getting back to the bartender there at mm-hmm. Chicago, there was about mm-hmm. five or six of us GIs, and of course, he started wanting to know if I was 21. I said no, because I was still 20.
Mm-hmm.
But he went ahead and served me anyway. You know, I think the other four guys there, they were 21.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he carded us all.
Mm-hmm.
But he served me anyway, which I'm glad he did. Of course, I would have probably really got pissed or something.
Mm-hmm.
Again, but,
yeah. Were you in uniform?
Yeah. Yeah, I was all in Class A uniforms. Nobody spit on me, or nobody shook my hand or spit on me or nothing. They just kind of, you know, ignored me. I mean, well, I just kind of blended in. I mean, you know, some people said they were spit on, but I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you would, can you give me your thoughts on a couple of these issues that really affected the whole country? And it's interesting to see what your individual experience was and what you thought. Can you tell me what you thought about the anti-war movement?
Yeah, well, I didn't think much of them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just really didn't have a good opinion of them. If I would have had a contact with them, I would probably got violent with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's a good thing I didn't have any contact.
Mm-hmm. Do you still feel that way today? I mean, are you bitter about that, or has your view changed?
It's changed some because I've become friends with a war protester, and they didn't realize the hurt and damage that they were causing,
mm-hmm.
which I believe they did.
You think they did know?
No, I think
oh.
they did do some hurt and damage,
oh.
Provided comfort to the enemy, I think.
Can you elaborate on that? What do you mean?
Well, go back to a Tet before, you know, that was a military defeat
mm-hmm.
for North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with the war protesters in this country, they turned the table. You know, just like I said, you know, America, love it or leave it at times. So.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, maybe. But I'm sure. But looking back, like I said, my attitude has softened some because,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them didn't realize what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's kind of hard to separate the politics from the warrior, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dave, what did you think about the war, you know, after you came home? Did you keep up with what was happening there?
Not really. Like I said, I kind of drank. I had nightmares the first 6 months, and then they stopped.
What kind of nightmares, if you don't mind asking?
Well, I'd always be surrounded by a bunch of VC, and they had weapons, and I didn't.
Hmm.
seemed like, and then I'd wake up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that ceased after a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said, there's always a feeling there that, you know, lost the war or something, you know, didn't do the right job, or I just really didn't have that good a feeling about my service in the country at the time.
What do you think about it now? How do you feel about it now?
Well, I guess I'm glad I served my country. I wish I hadn't, but, you know, I can't change the past.
What do you mean you wish you hadn't served your country?
Well, Vietnam's, I mean, you know, it's good, bad, or indifferent. It's part of me.
Mm-hmm.
Because of there.
Mm-hmm.
How much would I have been any different without Vietnam? Like I said, it just, stuff stayed with me, and there's just like an emptiness that I can't describe the feeling, I guess.
You still have that emptiness?
Not as acute as it used to be. Like I said, I went to a veterans group, got talking to other veterans, and
mm-hmm.
hooked up with some guys that I served in Vietnam with, and went to reunions, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, made friends with other vets that I didn't, that was in America that I didn't serve with, but, you know, I've been going to reunions for 5 years and
mm-hmm.
become friends with them. So.
Has that helped you heal a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, it's been therapeutic. So.
Is this the emptiness that we're talking about? Is this the same emptiness that you felt on that plane leaving Vietnam? Or is it something different?
It's kind of. It is. Like I said, I can't describe it other than being a kind of an emptiness feeling. And you know, what it is, you know, like the camaraderie or brotherhood we had, that, you know, we can't recapture it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just, I wish I could explain it, but I can't.
No, it's okay. I think you are explaining it in your own way. Is that something that you think is always going to be with you, no matter what you do?
Well, it's been 35 years, so I figure it's here for keeps. You know, the mental health professional, I call it post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, as myself, I've gotten more mellow as I've aged. So, and I've noticed other people, as they've gotten older, they seem to get more mellow and sentimental. So,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'll say it'll be with me until at least 3 days after they bury me.
Can you describe, Dave, what it feels like? I'm talking about describing for the civilian who's never been in combat, never been in a war, who might be listening to this, you know, 100 years from now, or just people listening to this in general now. Could you describe what that PTSD, if you will, feels like? What does it feel like to carry that war with you? Is it something that's thought about a lot, or is it something you think about every now and then? Is it kind of a weight on you, or is it what is it for you?
Well, it can be pretty much a daily thing. You know, things will trigger it, like items in the news.
Such as what?
Well, April 30th.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Anniversaries, mm-hmm. Triggers that any stressful situations in my life stirs it up. You know, it's not, you know, I'm not crazy, but mm-hmm. it affects my mood and, you know, it's something I got to live with. And, you know, by sharing it with other vets and somebody, you know, safe places, it lessens the load. I mean, you know, I'm not alone.
Definitely not.
And, you know, a lot of time I thought I was, you know. But it affects relationships with my ex-spouse, with my ex-wife, with my kids. But it's hard to recognize. I mean, you know, it's just part of me. And you know, it affects people different.
Yes. Why are you doing this interview with us, with me? Is there a reason specific, or is it part of this process?
Part of the process, and I suppose specific to, you know, to get some perspective of what it was like from down on the low end, you know. But, you know, it's, I just wish I could be more articulate about how I feel about it. But
I think you're being perfectly articulate, Dave.
It's just kind of hard to describe the feelings that, you know, I have. And for a long time, you know, I carried a lot of anger, but, you know, my anger was misplaced. It wasn't against the, you know, my anger really wasn't against these people. It was against my own government. I mean, the government did sell us out. I don't care what they say. And like I said, I really don't hold that much anger against the anti-war people. As for Jane Fonda, I wouldn't walk across the street not to meet her, but I wouldn't walk across the street. You know, I wouldn't go out of my way to meet her, and I wouldn't go out of my way not to meet her. I mean, you know, I don't give her that much power in my life. So.
Right. What did you think? Do you remember where you were April 30th, 1975?
I was sitting in the basement drinking beer.
Were you on watching TV?
I'd turned it off.
But, so you knew what was happening?
Yeah, I knew what was happening. I mean, you know, because I didn't want to watch it.
How much of it did you watch? And, like, when did you turn it off? Do you remember?
Probably the day before or something. I you know, they said they were, you know, just coming right down the country. So, you know, the handwriting was on the wall. So I don't think I watched any that day.
So you knew, you didn't actually watch the fall and the evacuation, all that? Or
no, no, I watched it up until the day before or something.
Well, what was it like last Saturday for you, the 30th anniversary?
It was okay.
Yeah?
It was okay. Like I said, it didn't really... It was okay. It didn't really hit me like it did some guys.
How did it affect other guys? Did you talk to some people?
Oh, yeah, they just... stirs up old memories, you know. But
so it did not have a big effect upon you.
No.
Okay.
No, not this time. No.
I mean, what about other April 30th? I mean,
it has in the past. You know, stirred up more memories.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to know what you thought about lessons for the United States. What do you think, as a country, we have learned from that experience in Southeast Asia?
Well,
or not learned? You know, either way.
Well, by the Gulf War, I thought we learned a lot, you know. And of course, we got Iraq. I don't know if we learned much or not.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like I said, I guess we're doomed to repeat history. So. I would like to think that the country would not get involved again unless we got the support to see it through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we never get into another Vietnam, I guess then it'd be worth it. I don't know. It's kind of hard to get into the politics of it, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
For me, everybody's got their opinion. I don't know. I guess Ho Chi Minh at one time tried to get the United States to back him.
Yes, he did, and against the Japanese in World War II, and we actually assisted with the precursor to the CIA. What did we not learn? I mean, are there things that you talked about stuff that you didn't quite get, or you would have maybe done differently? What do you think? Do you think the country has learned its lesson? Do you see differences today with what's happening with the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars?
I don't know if they have or not. Time will tell.
Okay.
You know, I wish we weren't in Iraq, but we're there. Let's see it through and come home. But like I said, I wish we weren't there, but too late for that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do you wish we weren't there?
Well, hate to see people get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some ways, the one who gets killed might be the lucky one. I mean, hate to see lives ruined, but, you know, guys come back all messed up physically and mentally, emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they're looking at them and helping them better than they did us.
Why do you think you all were treated like that? I know that the politics of the day definitely affected things, but why do you think that happened?
I guess it's been the politics, and people didn't really understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hell, I didn't understand what was going on.
Right.
I was there, so.
Right.
I guess that was just people just didn't realize what was going through.
Mm-hmm. So the misunderstanding was part of that?
I would say. I mean, you know, that's like, you know, today, you and I are going about our lives, and, you know, do we stop and think what some of the guys in Iraq are going through?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's not a shared sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you most learned in Vietnam about yourself?
Oh, I guess you learned that I couldn't survive about anything.
That what? You couldn't survive?
I can survive about anything, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I can get through some pretty tough stuff.
Uh-huh.
But also, like I said, I've learned that, you know, I'm not as tough as I once was or thought I was.
What do you mean?
I just get, like I said, I've got more emotional and softer in my old age. So. Mellow.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Vietnam today? Would you ever want to go back?
I don't have a real burning desire to go back, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't entirely rule it out after talking to a couple people that's been back.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some, like I said, I don't have no anger towards the people, mm-hmm. Vietnamese people, like I did have at one time. There is some pretty country here. I mean, mm-hmm. So, like I said, if it happens, it happens. If it don't, it don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you watch movies on Vietnam, Dave?
Some of them, yes.
Do you want to comment on the ones you've seen? Do you remember which ones you looked at and that you thought were worthwhile?
Well, Platoon stirred up a bunch of stuff for me.
Mm-hmm.
The Deer Hunter couldn't really. I see, that's the one where they played the Russian roulette, wasn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, that couldn't really relate to it. I mean, that was. Yeah, I couldn't really relate to that one.
Mm-hmm.
But Platoon, like I said, did the language and the dress and mm-hmm. the action. Well, except, you know, the big. When they're fighting among yourselves, I mean, but.
Mm-hmm. That didn't really. That wasn't realistic, you thought?
Nah, it's not to me. They're at the end or whatever, and. Well, the Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of stretched a little.
Yeah.
For me, but.
What, tell me, what was it about Platoon that rang true for you?
Just the way the guys was talking and, you know, and the dress and stuff early on, I guess, when, you know, when you first got there and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of rang true.
Mm-hmm. Have you read any books on Vietnam?
Yeah, I read a few of them. Got a couple to read, haven't read yet.
Yeah.
One that, Time Heals No Wounds by Jack Leninger, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
The infantryman, the 4th Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm.
They're around Play 2. Here's the, you know, I can relate to his, because he was drafted and, whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So you don't avoid the movies and you don't avoid reading about it?
Nah, I went and, here 5 or, nah, it's just about 7 or 8 years ago now. I got the Time Life video thing.
Mm-hmm.
Got it, watched it.
What'd you think of it?
It's fair and accurate, I guess. I mean, did it? They had a guy in there recognized.
Did you?
Yeah, or the Sergeant Ortiz. He was, mm-hmm. They had him there on his first tour. He was in one clip there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But like I said, just some of it I can rings true to me, and some of it don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you been to the wall in Washington?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
Well, the first time I was with the family. I just bit my lower lip and walked right down by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with the group, vets, and stood there just bawling like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Rubbed 4 names. And then I was back again for the 20th anniversary with reunion.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of neat.
Have you seen one of the moving walls?
Well, that's how I got hooked up with America Out of Asian Veterans Association.
The really? What happened?
Moving wall came through, and what is it? Anderson, the guy that was with us,
mm-hmm.
he was America Out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they had an association. That's how I joined the association.
You weren't looking for that. That just happened.
Yeah, it just happened. But, you know, that's, like I said, even if I knew 20 years ago there was an association, I wouldn't have joined then.
Okay.
But like I said, it's one of those things happens, you know. I guess you call it a God thing.
That's what some people might call it. But it clearly has played a role for you in the healing process. Can you tell me, I want to talk about just briefly the oral history project that the America Out Division has going on and your participation in that. Why do you want to participate in that?
Well, I like to see history be recorded accurately.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of have an interest in history.
Yeah.
I guess that's it. I just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess if we learn anything from it, we've learned that it will repeat itself.
Dave, let me, a couple other questions, and let's finish this up. I really would like to hear your comments on how you would talk to the younger generation today, high school students or college students, about the Vietnam War in general and about your experiences.
Well, in general, it's, I don't know how I would talk to them.
I mean, these are kids that's ancient history to them.
Yeah.
They can't find this on the map. It's very difficult to find it on the map.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you say to this group who is there and wants to know about the war?
That it was a political war run wrong.
A political war run wrong?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I guess grandkids just come in.
Okay. That sounds like a good noise.
Oh, yeah, that's a great noise.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard for me to express what to say to them. That, you know, it was, myself, you know, I really wasn't that gung-ho to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, a duty.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all owe some to our country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and we still disagree, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, I disagree with war protesters, but I'll defend to my death their right to protest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I tell them, beware of the government.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, because, like I said, the government lied to us.
How did they lie to us? What do you say to that when someone's going to say, no, they did the best they could?
Well, they might have, but, you know, they were whittling away in the Paris peace talks, giving everything away, I guess,
mm-hmm.
while we were still fighting and dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were over there when heavy negotiations were going on.
Yeah. And like I said before, you know, it changed while I was there from
mm-hmm.
from winning the war to not being the last GI killed.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to explain.
Dave, did you guys talk about the fact that negotiations were going on in Paris while you were over there fighting?
I don't remember.
Really?
What's talking about it.
Hmm. But you were aware that it was people were negotiating to end the thing.
I can't remember.
Okay. Okay.
To be honest, I can't remember.
Dave, well, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or anything else that you want to comment upon before we sign off?
No, I don't, you know, really, most of the guys that was there weren't there by choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's about the only thing I can, would like to be recorded, that I didn't go by my own free will. I just didn't have too many options. It's either that or jail or Canada. So.
Okay. All right. Well, this will end the oral history interview for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project with Mr. Dave Eichhorn. Thank you very much, Dave.
All righty. Thank you.